Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury inviting you to come and see why J.D. Power & Associates rated Lincoln Mercury top on your list. With extensive...
Starts to work in 15 to 30 minutes. Use as directed.
If human beings made the planet what it is, what will become of it?
When we're gone.
Monday, the History Channel presents a special two-hour television event that takes you beyond anything you can imagine. Go with the experts as they explore the evidence.
People think the structures they build will last forever. In reality, nature will reclaim the Earth very quickly.
Life After People, Monday at 9, 8 Central on the History Channel. Welcome to Earth. Population zero.
So the other day, I was in a Walmart shopping in cosmetics, just having a ball, checking out colors of lipstick, right? But then I noticed their pharmacy nearby. I guess I knew they had a pharmacy, but I didn't know, no. So I checked out some of the prices on their over-the-counter medicine. You know, the stuff you gotta have on hand if one of the kids gets sick. Well, they had the lowest prices. Period. They guarantee it. Wow, right? Well, I guess I shouldn't be too surprised. I did find the pharmacy in Walmart.
One great pharmacy, lots of low prices. Save money, live better. Walmart.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Jalene Jordan is with me. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter. Good evening.
It's pretty lame to talk about the weather, but it's going to be 2 below 0 tonight here in the Detroit area.
Just a tad bit cold for this girl.
And, right, you being from Iowa, it's a little cold.
Yes, Yes. The 3 years I spent in Miami completely ruined me.
I guess so.
Yeah.
But I was, right... Talking out of outside of school or talking out of class or something like
that.
But before, just about, 30 seconds before we're going on, we're both going,
does a number on the throat.
But it does.
Yeah. As we speak, I'm having one of those electric fireplaces put together at my house. I'm so cold. I couldn't take it. I said, must have more heat.
You know, let's not talk too much about the weather. But I was thinking, 100 years ago, there was no central heat. I mean, people...
That's true.
Yeah. I mean,
wood and fire.
And coal. We expect it to be warm and toasty all the time.
Oh, sure we do.
And in the summer, we expect it to be nice and cool.
We're such folks of privilege.
Yeah, and it's probably all going to go away. One of these days, remember I was almost making my signature for this broadcast, but I don't know where to start. And meaning there are so many scandals, so much abuse of people and of the planet as you see tonight, and your side too, just extended across the console.
Yeah.
Here are story after story after story of there's some good stuff and what people can do and what people are doing to change this this disaster we're heading towards. And I mean disaster.
Right, the disaster we're in.
Yes, on all levels. And
absolutely.
So one of the things, tonight I don't have to say I don't know where to start, because we should start with the economy. Now, I remember over the last few years, whenever I bring up economic things, I think, I'm probably not building my ratings here, because most people don't understand, including me, the economy in depth, and in fact, to the extent that I don't think it's possible. I mean, you always have these people, everybody from professors to investment, advisors and rich people and all that, and they're always, filled with all this advice, and... sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. In times of what they call a bull market, when the market's expanding, you'll get books like Dow Jones 40,000. So it's going to go up from, I forgot what it was when it was written, maybe 8,000 or 9,000. It was going to go up to 40,000. The book was, I think, 1997, 1998 there. And then, it all crashed on the dot-com scandals. And so when it's in a bear market, when it's contracting, like what's happening now you start having people saying, everything's going to collapse. We're going to go back to the dark ages. That gold is going to be worth $100 an ounce. The value of the dollar is going to be eroded by 90%.
So. Well, people are terrified.
Yeah, because we're in the grasp of forces and people of which the majority of us have absolutely no power. So when I talk about the elite, the command center, the ruling class, the elite, whatever you want to call it, the power elite, you know, this isn't like name-calling. This is descriptive.
It's not just liberal rhetoric.
No, right.
It's reality.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to be able to make some definitions in order to have an understanding. Now, I don't know if the economy can be understood in the conventional meaning of the word.
True.
I mean, I don't know if you can understand anything.
Well, it's very complex.
Let's start with that. Yeah. Well, I mean, think about this. Do you fully, absolutely, 100% understand any person? No.
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 And
right.
Even if you could be married to them forever, and you still may not fully understand them.
Tell me about it. I do. Yeah.
Two failed marriages, I can't.
Yeah. You, not me.
Me, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You're a lifer.
Yes. That kind of stopped me for a second. So something where there are so many countervailing forces involved and so many complexities and so many different theories and all of that, it's really difficult. But what you can really, I guess, look at is what is happening.
Yes.
And it ain't good. Remember, this is kind of like a storm. I'm beginning with this housing crisis, the bubble, that the price of homes was way inflated. All these people were given subprime, means people were giving these
shoddy
mortgages. Yeah, yeah. And over, you know, that half the people that got subprime loans, that is loans above the going rate, qualified for lower rates of interest. And in other words, these realtors just scammed them.
Yes.
So they took all this real bad debt and they bundled them, and then they sent them off to larger investment firms, which then sold them to But here,
it'll make the head spin.
Yes. Citigroup, the nation's largest bank, reported a staggering fourth quarter loss of $10 billion on Tuesday and issued a sobering forecast that the housing market and the broader economy still had not bottomed out. To shore up their financial condition, Citigroup and Merrill Lynch, which has also been rocked by the subprime mortgage debacle, whichever.
As I would say it.
Which?
Debacle.
Debacle.
Yeah.
Some say debacle. Okay. Both were forced again to go. Get this. Citigroup and Merrill Lynch. Listen to the language here. This is the New York Times. This is the business section. This is the newspaper of the rulers, the more liberal ones, to be sure. But the ones that are the sober managers of the economy, not like morons like Bushko and these people that think only in terms of fourth quarter profits. These are people that have had money forever and want to have money forever. And they sent in their news reporting, their columns, they want to give the people that are making the decision some correct information. So listen to the language here. To shore up their financial condition, Citigroup and Merrill Lynch, which has also been rocked by the subprime mortgage debacle, both were forced again to go hat in hand. Citigroup and Merrill Lynch were forced to go hat in hand for cash infusions from investors in the United States. That's just in there for window dressing. Forget about that. Asia and the Middle East for a total combined total of nearly $19.1 billion.
Right.
Citigroup's gloomy news will most likely amplify the anxiety of consumers and workers, already concerned that the mortgage crisis could plunge the economy into a recession.
And I think that entire sentence is called putting it lightly.
Yeah, yeah. And what happens, of course, the farther you are down on the economic scale, it's...
you're affected by it.
Well, yeah. So I was going to say, if you're way up there, you suffer some losses. If you're in the middle class, you could be in a recession. If you're a worker or a poor person, it's a depression. It's 1933. It's 1896 you. And let's see. Retail sales off in December. First time they've declined since 2002. Growing pessimism that led to another sharp sell-off in stocks, which fell about 2% for the day and are now down about 6% since the beginning of 2008, the third worst start for a year since 1926.
Since 1926.
Yeah.
Yowza.
Citigroup's loss was caused by write-downs from, and don't even worry about all the write-down, whatever the hell they're talking, from soured mortgage-related securities and reserves for current and future bad loans, totaling $23.2 billion. Some longtime listeners may remember how I've reversed this old saying. Back in, I don't know, the 1920s and 1930s, speaking of, when you said to somebody, blah, 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 they'd say to you, well, if you're so smart, how come you're not rich?
Oh,
yeah,
right.
That was the ultimate put down. So to which I say to all these people, they're so rich, how come they're not smart?
I like how you turn that around.
I mean, wouldn't you think that, as dumb as Bush is, as an individual, and as lazy he is to try to figure this out, isn't he surrounded by people that have some brains? I mean, they're evil.
We think so.
Yeah, they're evil. They're mean. They lie. They do all this stuff. But they are really representatives of the ruling class, the elite. So you would think they would want to keep, what do you call it?
Well, they're the ultimate spinsters, I guess.
But in forgetting about the spin that comes out of all this, what about the reality? What about a country that had a surplus of money, and then because of tax breaks in this horrid war that was based on lies, drives the country into debt? I mean, didn't these other rich guys say, I don't think this is a good idea?
Yeah, you would think. And meanwhile, it looks like the bank, Citigroup, is going to lay off another 4,000 workers on top of the announced reductions of 17,000 employees and cut its dividend to conserve $4.4 billion cash annually.
Well, think about that. 21,000 employees, I would suspect the majority of them have families.
Yeah.
The majority of them live in middle-class communities. What the hell does that do? Remember that guy? Let me see if I still have that. I had this email from last week.
Oh, was he the one who said, who cares about, I'm taking care of myself.
Yeah.
That's all that matters. What's wrong with everyone else?
Yeah, he didn't sign his name. His first initial is D. I don't believe in the extensive social programs. I take care of myself. I don't need the government in my business. So I hope he wasn't a
sweetheart.
Yeah, well, forgetting about his lack of compassion, what about just, he says he looks out for himself.
Yeah.
You have no social programs, and you work for Citibank.
And so, when is this going to happen to you? What will you do?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is a talk show. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan at your service here. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And for the bashful, and when the lines are filled, you can go to calltalkyes. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short messages are... appreciate it. Yes. Well, this is sort of just a little diversion. We talked almost unusually last show, Jolene, about the primaries. And remember, it was sort of Ron Paul versus
Dennis Kucinich.
And at one point, I said it was an exercise in obscurantism. And a conversation about obscure people. So the two of them between them didn't get 10%, I don't think.
I don't think so. I mean, we knew that.
Well, I guess.
Potentially. But we were hoping because of, all of the weirdness with the Democratic Party and those who weren't involved that maybe Kucinich might do a little better.
Well, yeah. Or that Democrats would cross over and vote for Ron Paul attempt to screw up the Republicans with somebody who was actually really against the war and NAFTA and WTO and all that. But it's interesting, or maybe it just says something about our listeners that, that no one called up and said, well, I'm for Hillary or I'm for Romney or somebody like that. You know, it was just all these minority candidates.
Very focused on that. Maybe they're the in radio, the P1, the ones who listen the most. Maybe they're our P1s. I don't know.
Yeah. Sheldon Drobny, who founded Air America. Which I was going to say we worked for. We didn't work for them, did we?
We do know him.
Yes, we know him. And he's written an article that said that Bush tax cuts made subprime fiasco possible. So essentially, there's something, should I go here? There's what they call supply side economics. This is right. All Reaganomics and all that from Reagan. And what it means is you give tax breaks to corporations, which allows them, rather than money going to government, they use it to ostensibly create jobs because they expand their businesses and then the workers get more money or more workers are hired, and that's the supply side. I mean, it's a load of crap, and it just winds up making corporations more money.
Okay.
But, I never realized this, and that's why it's unfortunate that you really have to be a student, a scholar, to figure out all this crap. I mean, it ought to be. It's about our lives. It ought to be simple, right in front of our face.
Yet it's not at all.
Yeah, right in front of our face, but always behind our back.
Right.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So Sheldon Drobny, who founded IE America, now runs
Nova
M Radio. And what do they say? Full disclosure, I've substituted as a talk show host on both networks. And I think Sheldon's really a smart guy. If you just Google him, it's Drobny, Sheldon Drobny. Anyway, who's that person that corrected me one time? It's singular. Anyway.
Don't email.
Yeah, don't email. I'm stand corrected. That the tax cuts that Bush, the guy that's in all this trouble, that wasn't for corporations, which would be supply-side economics, but was for wealthy individuals.
I'm so shocked.
Well, no. We knew that. We kept saying it for his rich buddies. But I always think of Bush & Co.'s rich buddies as being the corporations, which they were. Well, they did get a bit of a break on different things. But so what happened? That all this money. Remember, somewhere in here I have this too. That the amount of money, the rich getting richer. Isn't that still here? Maybe who can keep track of all this? But anyway, the amount of money that the rich made in a couple of years was more money just than what they made, not what they had total, but just what they made in this 2-year period, thanks to Bush, was more than the combined wealth of the bottom 40%.
That's right. I do remember that. We talked about that last week, right?
We did. So what did these people do with the money? They actually invested it in like venture and speculative enterprises and speculative capital. So it did was go into the stock market and then just make them, up till recently, lots more money. So they and in the meantime, we're paying more and more. Inflation's growing at this rapid rate, which means our money is worth more and more. So if you're making $50,000 or $20,000 in a year, and there's inflation, your value of the labor that you were paid for has dropped. So this is really a case, folks, of the rich getting richer and the poor, which includes the middle class and the working class and the poor, are getting poorer. And it's looting. The wealthy, led by Bush Co., this racket posing as a government, is looting us. The only reason I'm laughing, too, is because I'm a victim of this. You're a victim of this.
Absolutely.
I say that frequently.
Yes.
One of my little pet phrases.
One of these things. I was preparing for the show tonight, and I am just in the worst mood about all of this stuff. Sometimes, and I talk about this from time to time, when you absorb yourself so deeply in what's really going on in the world, and you don't just kind of candy coat over it and just, the war in Orlando and whatever. I am just in the most rotten mood about this tonight, and I wonder if there's anyone else who feels just like I do. I bet there is.
313-298-WRIF. From time to time, over the years, Julian, I've had people write and tell me, or I've even seen me discussed on bulletin boards or lists or blogs, saying, Werby must be the most unhappy, miserable person there is.
Which is not true at all.
Yeah. That's not in the nature of the human spirit. I mean, you think of the attempts that people made in the death camps, Jews made in the death camps in Europe during World War II, given just a little bit of space, they would create a play or something.
Right. Yeah.
When the Serbs were bombing, what the hell's the name of the city? Sarajevo, in Bosnia. And they were up in the mountains. They would just bomb the city and the squares where people assembled. And if the bombardment would stop even for a little bit, people would go out in the cafes immediately.
Yeah.
So we all live in Sarajevo. Oh yeah, here. I'm right. The second thing I was looking at. Report says that the rich are getting richer faster, much faster. Our friend Greg Palast, Palast. Says, those bills in your billfold aren't yours anymore. The landlords of our currency. Get the language here, folks. The landlords of our currency, Citibank, the National Treasury of China, and the House of Saud are foreclosing and evicting all Americans from the U.S. economy. Let's begin by stating why Bush is not in Saudi Arabia. Remember, he was over there seeing his pals. Yeah. Did you see? It looks like he's about to give him just a big kiss on the lips.
They like PDA. Remember, they were holding hands.
Oh yeah. You folks know what PDA is? Yeah.
Public displays of affection.
Right.
Yeah.
Bush isn't there to promote democracy nor peace in Palestine, nor even war in Iran. And despite some pinhead from CNN, stated, he sure as hell didn't go to Riyadh, to the capital of Saudi Arabia, to tell the Saudis to cut the price of oil. What's really behind the Bush Hajj to Riyadh, the pilgrimage, is that America is in hock up to our knickers. The subprime mortgage market implosion hitting a dozen banks with over $100 billion in losses is just the tip of the debtberg. I like Greg Palast.
Yeah, I like him too.
You can go to his website, Greg and Palast, like Palast.com. Since taking office, Bush has doubled the federal debt to more than $5 trillion, and according to U.S. Treasury figures, foreign investors have purchased close to 100% of that debt. That's $3 trillion borrowed from the Saudis, the Chinese, the Japanese, and others.
Wow.
Now, Bush, our debt junkie-in-chief, needs another fix. The U.S. Treasury, Citibank, Merrill Lynch, and other financial desperados need another handout from Abdullah's stash. Abdullah, in turn, gets this financial juice by pumping it out of our pocket at nearly $100 a barrel for his crude oil. Bush needs the Saudis to charge us big bucks for oil. Is that clear? In other words, Bush, this whole thing that we were... erase the pronoun there. The whole reason that Bush invaded Iraq was not to have a cheap supply of oil, but to control oil and to keep it up at a high price.
That's right.
The Saudis can't lend the U.S. Treasury and Citibank hundreds of billions of U.S. dollars unless they first get these U.S. dollars from the U.S. This is a con game. This is called looting, folks. We are paying for the misdeeds of these wealthy corporations and individuals. We are bailing them out. They always talk about this is not a bailout. This is a bailout, and we're bailing them out. Let me see. The high price of crude is, in effect, a tax levied by Bush, but collected by the oil industry and the Gulf kingdoms to fund our multi-trillion dollar governmental and private debt load. There's a lot more here. Bush is there to assure Abdullah that unlike Dubai's ports purchase Dubai debacle. Remember, that was when they sold, they're going to sell off our part. They're going to sell off everything. He wants to guarantee there's going to be no political impediment to the Saudis buying up Citibank nor the island
or
of
impediment?
Manhattan.
Or impediment?
What?
Or impediment.
Impediment?
Yeah.
Let's move on. Thanks to Shelby of, why am I blanking?
RadioPower.org.
Yeah, sorry, Shelby.
Hello, Shelby.
Yeah, hi, Shelby. I just, my mind's in 19 different directions. Here, she sent me this. Overseas investors buy aggressively in the U.S. Last May, a Saudi Arabian conglomerate bought a Massachusetts plastic maker. In November, a French company established a new factory in Adrian, Michigan, adding 189 automotive jobs to an area accustomed to layoffs. I bet it ain't going to be union. In December, a British company bought a new Jersey maker of syrup. Now, this is going, last year, foreign investors poured a record $414 billion into securing stakes in American companies, factories, and other properties through private deals and purchases of publicly traded stock. That was up 90% from the previous year and more than double the average for the last decade. One of the things that that in the so-called third world that had been devastated in the 19th and 20th century by colonialism and imperialism, and it was objected to by the people of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, was that American firms owned the resources and the utilities and the companies in their homeland, and they extracted the profits and took them back to what was called the metropole, or to the United States and Britain and France that were the colonial powers, mm-hmm. or, in case of the United States, the imperial power. So this is what's going to be happening to us, folks.
Well, it is with Coca-Cola and a lot of these corporations in South America. Yeah.
Well, I had a lot more, but, man, it's like endless. National debt grows at $1 million a minute. We said that one.
Oh, $1 million a minute. We didn't say that. But I did read that earlier, and that sent me even further into my anger and depression tonight.
Well, it's tomorrow's Martin Luther King's the celebration, Martin Luther King, Jr., and there's going to be the 5th annual MLK Day rally in March for 2008. If you're in Detroit, It's going to occur, the march and the rally, at the Central United Methodist Church at noon, which is Woodward at East Adams in downtown Detroit, kind of near the Fox.
Oh, Fox Theater. Okay.
The Fox Theater. Right. There's stuff, I'm sure, going on around the country as well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I want to get to this caller right away because one of the things. So what are we going to do about this? So we're complaining. Well, as individuals, folks, we're just screwed. We have absolutely no power. We're talking about massive concentrated wealth and political power that is impervious to us as a scattered individuals. And as I've said all along, we've got two choices. We either have to combine in the type of movement that has shaped American history, or admit we're peasants and thatch our roofs. Okay? And just hope that the lords of the land and the economy treat us fairly decent.
Oh, Peter.
And you know what? They won't. They won't. They absolutely won't. They never have throughout history. They've always screwed the average person. That's how they get their wealth. And by fooling us, that's how they keep their power.
And remember, if you remember anything tonight, remember that sentence right there.
All right. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. But and there's somebody who wants to talk about this. But so Bushco has a scheme. We're going to get an $800, how are they characterizing
it? A rebate.
Rebate on our taxes,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but then you'll get taxed on it.
Yeah. Well, Steve from the staff here at WRIF was reminding us that in 2001, is that it turned out that you were just getting an early tax rebate from a refund.
You had to pay it back.
And if you did, yeah, if they gave you, and they taxed it. But let's see, I'm curious because all the details of it are a little swimming in my brain. See if Dave's got a better idea or better understanding of Dave. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us. Where are you calling from?
Detroit.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to get your opinion on that thing where Bush is talking about sending a $500 to $800 check to individual taxpayers and like $1,500 to $1,800 per couples. And I'm just curious, what do you think the total of that come to? And what, are we going to borrow it from China?
Well, yeah. Or maybe they'll just print it. You get the Fed just to print off some more cash.
It's more than $100 billion in one-time tax rebates is what is expected, what they're saying. And then also, of course, the criticism is that for the poor, who they say it will leave millions of poor Americans who don't earn enough to pay income taxes, so they'll get nothing. The poor won't get anything.
Don't they say it's like 45 million families? Isn't that in there somewhere?
It's not in this article, but I do know. I think you're right.
You know, we both lost that article. I don't know, but I was struck. It wasn't 45 million people. What, there's 300 million people now. So this is 45 million families. That wouldn't qualify.
Oops, sorry, not you.
Yeah.
Are you still there?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I wonder what the subsidy checks for the oil companies and these credit companies are going to come to, because I know that they're going to be included in it too.
Yeah, they are. Well, they're talking about that's where what's called the supply side economics comes in. So Bush actually wants to throw the money, but let them pay even less taxes. American corporations pay less taxes than any national corporations in the entire world. And so we make it up. I mean, there's, somebody's got to pay the freight on all of this. And if people want things in this world or in this country, let's say, structured exactly the way they are, with a $500 billion a year military budget and 700 to 800 bases across the world and all the rest of it, somebody has to pay for it. And it is the richest people could pay for it, way disproportionately to the middle class and the working class, the wealthy. And, well, I'm sorry, or the I've got lost in my sentence. But either it's a social and political question. Who's going to pay for it? Is it going to be the middle class and the working class, or is it going to be the corporations and the wealthy? Well, my vote is for the wealthy and the corporations. How about you, Dave?
We're going to wind up paying the freight on it no matter what happens.
Well, I think you're right.
You're right.
All right, thank you for joining us. Let's move on.
At least he's real.
Yeah, right. Wait a minute here. My mouse is stuck here. All right, there we go. Man, what is going on here? All right, here's Al in Inkster. Al, you think I'm wrong on something?
Yes, we're not paying for Bush's oil policies once, as you implied.
Oh, they're stealing it.
Twice and three times when you throw in tax breaks to the corporations. We just sold them $20 billion in ARM, which we financed through, you know, giving companies tax breaks for the ARMs companies.
Yeah, we gave
it. Twice we paid for it.
Yeah.
Three times we're paying for it right now because we got that army over there burning up money like it's wood in the Michigan winter.
Yeah, but that, of course, benefits Bushko's pals. The whole military-industrial complex is what he represents. And they want to burn through profits as fast as absolutely possible. And people say they just think about the quarterly profits. I mean, it's daily profits they're thinking about. Whereas, like I said, the New York Times represents the section of the elite that has a long-term and more moderate view on profit-taking. Because they know that Bushko is sending the whole ship down the...
Drain?
Drain, yeah. I was thinking some other word that I'd probably get fired for.
Down the crapper?
Down the crapper, yeah.
We won't get fired for that one.
No, thank you, Al. 313-298-WRIF. And, all right, so we were talking about how this plays out in terms of the big players, the corporations, the banks, the Saudis, Bushko, all of that. And we come back, let's talk a little about the people that are really getting ground up by it, by all this goings on here at home.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, Ann. Joined by Jolene Jordan. We're talking about the economy, which is quickly going into the crapper and, of course, hurts the average person the most. That's who really gets it. Steve writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. A small percentage of overly aggressive people never learn what their mommy should have taught them to share and care about others. So all of their efforts are devoted to tilting the playing field completely and unfairly in their favor. They don't care how badly the rest of the population are hurt by their actions, even if those others completely have their rights, money, livelihoods, health, and happiness taken away. Basically, our worst psychopaths have muscled their way into taking over every aspect of our society, and we all have let them.
Wow, that was very well put.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
That's all right. Thanks,
Steve. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, that's true, and but it's been true ever since the rise of classes and government and all that. The whack jobs take over. I mean, think about, and we always talk about, like, the emergence of government, the political state, as being this advance, right?
Yeah.
Well, it was, I mean, the state, the political state, arose as a racket to protect the wealth and privilege, of this elite that had emerged. I mean, it's, again, as we said earlier about complex stuff, it's very complex. But the state pretty much arose as a racket. I mean, there wasn't a state racket here in Michigan with the people when the European invasion came. The Iroquois and the I don't know, were the Iroquois here? But the Hurons, the Potawatomis, and the people like that. I mean, they didn't have a horizontal or vertical racket,
right,
the way the political state is. And
exactly.
They didn't. Yeah. So anyway, how does it affect all of us? I said last week, England now, their living standards outstrip the U.S. So we're not number one there, folks, though, you number oners. Gas and food spur inflation jump in 2007.
The fastest pace in 17 years, Peter.
Yeah. Thank you, Bushko.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Yeah. Blue-collar jobs disappear, taking families' way of life along. After 30 years, this is from Jackson, Ohio, New York Times on the 16th. After 30 years at a factory making truck parts, Jeffrey Evans was making $14.55 a year, which is about
an hour, which is about
$28,000 or $29,000 a year in what he called one of the better paying jobs in the area. Look at that to begin with. So, but he's at the median for white males. That's the median income. So it means half the people are making less, half the people are making more. Half the people in this country are making less than $28,000 a year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. This is yet another article that sent me downhill.
It's so depressing.
Middle-aged
men moving in with parents, wives taking two jobs, veteran workers taking overnight shifts at half their former pay, families moving west. You know, they have now a phenomenon called halfback. Did you ever hear
of
this?
Oh, no.
It means that people have moved to the south or to the west, and they don't want to come back to Michigan. This is a Michigan term. So they wind up going to Tennessee, North Carolina, places like that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. These are signs of turmoil and stress is emerging in the little towns and backwoods mobile homes of southeast Ohio, where dozens of factories and several coal mines have closed over the last decade. Wow. Throughout the state of Ohio, the percentage of families living below the poverty line, just over 20,000 for a family of four. Imagine that. Imagine trying to live on...
family of four?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, 20 grand. Yeah. In fact, the last line in this... or in the paragraph says, the numbers are more dismal in the southeastern Appalachian. I just hear it. I know. We usually say Appalachian, right?
Go ahead. I'm done correcting
part
you.
Of the state where 32% of the families...
Well, I could be wrong.
32% of the families lived below the poverty line in 2007, which means below, 20,000 or less,
right,
according to the study, and 56% with incomes less than 40,000 for a family of four. Which a... And these are the people, they're not going to get a tax rebate, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What is it? Oh, did I send you this? The new global oil quandary, costly fuel means costly calories?
I was thinking about the one about stress and heart attacks in the war.
But we'll get to that one.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah.
Rising prices for cooking oil are forcing residents of Asia's largest slum in Mumbai, India, used to be Bombay, to ration every drop. Bakeries in the United States are fretting over higher shortening costs. And where this is being written from, Malaysia, brand new factories built to convert vegetable oil into diesel sit idle. Their owners unable to afford the raw material. There's food riots have erupted in recent months in Guinea, Mauritania,
wow.
Mexico, Morocco, Senegal, Uzbekistan, and Yemen. Where else did they say? Oh, yeah, in some poor countries, desperation is taking hold. Just in the last week, protests have erupted in Pakistan over wheat shortages and in Indonesia over soybean shortages. Egypt has banned rice exports to keep the food at home, and China has put price controls on cooking oil, grain, meat, milk, and eggs.
Oh, happy day.
So, as I'm saying, folks, it's looking grim. So, I mean, so you think, yeah, in fact, I'm turning off this program. Don't do it. Yeah, we've got all the answers on how this can be turned around in the next week or so. Jillian, go ahead.
Let's start with get Bush out of office.
Well, something really dramatic has to occur.
Yes. Wait. How about this? Revolution, Peter.
Revolution, yeah. Direct action will get you satisfaction.
Right on, brother.
Yeah. But all joking aside,
right.
There has, at a minimum, there has to be something like the Roosevelt New Deal that began in 1933, something that completely restructures this. Well, I mean, it wasn't completely restructured. I don't mean to say that. But some structural reforms that have to do with the distribution of wealth, with the insane profit-taking, with the privileging of the already wealthy. All of that. If that doesn't change dramatically, and change has to be something more than on a lawn sign in a primary, because
absolutely true, or over an overpass.
Yeah, when you look,
Ron Paul.
When you look at Ron Paul, at least I mean he gets into this stuff about the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and all that, and how badly it's hurt the United States and helped the elites. And Dennis Kucinich, too, but they're not being backed with tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of big money, they can't even get their message heard, so they're fringe candidates.
That's right.
All right, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. Looks like we have a good stack of calls.
All right, let's go here. Here's Jim and Frazier. Jim, hi, it's Peter and Jillian. You're on the air.
Yeah, Pete, you guys and Jillian, you guys must be really happy because, hey, it looks like Hillary's going to become the next president, and that means we got a Democrat.
Why would you think we'd be happy if Hillary was going to be the candidate?
Well, I'm being a little bit sarcastic.
He's being facetious.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Because that would not thrill us.
I mean, looking back at the 90s, I mean, doesn't it seem like as if, like, going back to the Clinton era would be like a step backwards, or, I mean, am I the only one who feels that way?
Probably.
Yeah, because I think anything right now would be a step forward.
I mean, don't you like it when, if you're working, are you working, Jim?
Yeah, like 30 hours a week.
Don't tell me, and tell me you're a Republican and a Bush supporter.
No, sir. No, I'm not.
That's good. That's good. That's good. Yeah. Because when I hear that, I just think, oh, man. But at least then there was a balanced budget. At least there was a minimum of wars. Think about this. The biggest thing to roil to the administration of Bill Clinton was that he had sex with an intern and he lied about it. Boy, that sounds like wonderful to get back to that, as opposed to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of issues that Bush has stabbed this country in the back. I mean, little things, little regulatory changes that he's made in work standards and environmental standards and weight and safety standards,
right?
And
so
all
many
that.
Things, Peter, that people have no idea about. That they've flown under the radar, but they're
right. What, Jim?
Now, isn't it true that Bill Clinton is like receiving like $6 billion a year from like Dubai or Bahrain or one of those countries?
Well, I haven't heard that, but do you think I'd be surprised? I never was a supporter of Bill Clinton, nor am I a supporter of Hillary Clinton. I mean, I've gotten to the point where, I mean, I didn't used to vote. I mean, to me, it was Tweedledum and Tweedledummer, you know, with the Republicans being the Tweedledummer. And why bother? Why? And I would say self-righteously, why? They're both evil. Why should I vote for the lesser of the two evil? Well, now.
Now you hold your nose and you
now
go.
I hold my nose and figure it's better to have a less evil than a more evil.
And but, you know what? There's Bill Clinton, I have to say, his foundation is doing more than the United States government is doing to help alleviate the AIDS situation in Africa, more than our own government.
I don't even like to defend Clinton.
Even when he deserves it. He is doing something good
there. And is he getting billions from Dubai?
I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me. Yeah,
anybody else know about this? Give us a call. 313-298-WRIF. We have to sneak in a few things here. Never mind. I'll have to get it before I can sneak it in. But I will pull it out of my little stack in just a minute. Here's Paul and Romulus. Paul, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us. Paul, are you
Hello?
With it? Yeah, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just making some macaroni and cheese because that's all I can afford to eat.
See, nice. There you go. That, maybe a little ramen?
Oh, no, no ramen. I got the deluxe macaroni and cheese.
Oh, dude, you are living big.
I'm up there. But, what I just can't understand is no politician is talking about this cost of fuel that we're paying.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
It just amazes me.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I really don't understand. I just can't figure it out because the cost of fuel goes up and then everything else goes up as well.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, Paul, just as a political issue, not that I take any of what they say during these primaries, particularly during these primaries, but even what they say, you know, before the election. Remember George Bush talked about being a uniter and that he was going to be president of all the people. He loses the popular vote in 2000, and he immediately initiates a far right-wing agenda. So nothing he said. I mean, most people were wise to him. That's why he lost the popular vote. But you would think, just for rhetorical reasons, for campaigning reasons, that one of these folks would get in there and say, when I become president, the first thing I do is I'll guarantee you the price of gasoline will drop by $1 no matter what I have to do. But
even if you're lying to us, can someone say it?
Well, I mean, you would think they would just use it opportunistically.
Yeah, absolutely.
But maybe, you know, maybe they think, well, I'm going to be president, and I'm going to have to be over in Saudi Arabia with my hat in my hand.
Yeah, maybe they know they're screwed and they can't do anything about it.
Yeah, but we agree with you. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah.
313-298-WRIF.
Enjoy your mac and cheese.
Yes. Here's Joe and Warren. Joe, hi, you're on the air. Hey, Joe.
Hello?
Hey, Joe, yeah. Go ahead. You're on the air. Turn your radio off. Radio off. Turn off the radio.
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
Yeah,
just
you.
Turn it down all the way down.
Bad things will happen to you.
No.
John, turn the radio off.
Turn it off! John.
Peter.
Okay, this is Joe from Warren. Jolene,
yes.
Peter, I love your show.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
That's fantastic. Now, I got a question.
Sure.
Okay, we're getting $800 from Bush, right?
Maybe.
We're hoping. Wouldn't our economy get stimulated more if that money he's giving the people in Afghanistan spend it over here?
Well, they're not giving anything to people. Well, they are. Some.
It's in Iraq. We're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, there's money. There's all these that's the whole. That's the military-industrial complex, Joe. Is that they're in order to build up the economy on that basis. We pay for tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons to go in and destroy things, and then we give Halliburton and the rest of those companies hundreds of billions of dollars to rebuild it. But we haven't gotten around to that. But you have hit it right on the head. We are spending $500 billion a year. Jolene, do you know the answer to this? What number comes after a trillion? Is it I know what it is. A quadrillion.
Is that what it is?
It is. I was trying to think of this.
Well, that
today.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Try.
Yeah.
Quadrillion.
Okay. So if in 10 years, man, what does that come out to?
I have always begged you to not ask any math questions.
Yeah, I don't know. When do you hit a quadrillion? So this is all down, you know, the rat hole of the military-industrial complex. And, Joe, you're absolutely right. The military budget should be cut by 75%, as Ron Paul says, the Republican, that we ought to dismantle the 700 to 800 foreign bases, bring them all back home, reduce the taxes to almost nothing on 80% of people in this country, and us and the rest of the world could probably live happily ever after.
Sounds good. Can I ask you something about the election?
Sure.
Now, my vote towards president doesn't count, correct?
Why?
What do you mean?
Oh, he's talking about the
electoral college.
Oh, yeah. Well, no. It counts because you're electing what they call electors. So if Michigan goes for Hillary or Obama or Dennis Kucinich, you will be electing Kucinich electors. So I forget how many we have. Is it equal to the senators and the representatives we have? I think it is. Let's say that is, and that's our, 15, 17? I don't know.
I thought it was 12.
Maybe it was more. I don't know. Anyway, so then they would go to the Electoral College. It's not like the College of Musical Knowledge that some of you may remember.
What?
I just had one of those bizarre
names. Was that a flashback?
Yeah,
a
flashback. But so the Electoral College then votes up, takes the tally of all the electors. But that's bad because here you can see, forgetting about the fact that the Supreme Court stole the election for Bush in 2000, say that they didn't. Say that it was on the up and up. That even though Bush lost the popular election and got less votes than Al Gore, through the Electoral College vote, he won. And that happened in the 19th century as well. So, no, the Electoral College is terrible. So we got to move on. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call.
Yes. Hey,
just a little thing in here. This is the Department of Major Oops. This came in on the Reuters Newswire. Canada placed the United States and Israel on their torture watch list.
And so they have their own version of the axis of evil?
Yes. So our neighbor to the south, yeah, I didn't misspeak myself, folks.
Canada.
Is the south
because
of us.
Because we're in Detroit.
Yeah. But to our neighbor to the north, Canada's foreign ministry has put the United States and Israel on a watch list of countries where prisoners risk being tortured and also classifies some U.S. interrogation techniques as torture, according to the document that they got. The revelation is likely, do you think, to embarrass the minority conservative Canadian government, which is a staunch ally of both the United States and Israel. But both nations denied they allow torture in their jails. That was on Friday the 18th. By January 20th, that's today, the Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Maxime Bernier, said Saturday that he had ordered officials to rewrite an internal government manual that listed the United States among countries that potentially torture or abuse prisoners. Mr. Bernier said, "I regret the embarrassment caused by public disclosure of the manual used in the department's torture awareness training. It contains a list that wrongly includes some of our closest allies.
Right.
I have directed that the manual be reviewed and rewritten." The United States government has repeatedly said it does not torture prisoners, an assurance that has been accepted by Canada's conservative government. Because these evil conservatives.
What do they call
that,
the backstroke? You doing the backstroke?
You what?
This person.
Oh, backpedaling.
Backpedaling. Well, swimming, it's the backstroke.
Yeah, right. But you remember, you know, conservatives, they don't think waterboarding is torture.
Right, and we're not talking about the recreational kind. Like, you know, going out and getting behind a boat.
Okay.
Because there are people who listen who have no idea what waterboarding is. It's a form of torture where they say they're going to drown you and then you confess.
Yeah, they say it's simulated drowning. Actually, it's drowning. It's drowning.
Yeah, it really is.
The document includes the United States on a list of nations under the heading Possible Torture Abuse Cases. Another slide titled Definition of Torture lists six U.S. interrogation techniques that it describes as non-physical, including blindfolding, covering heads and hoods, forced nudity, and sleep deprivation. So these conservatives say, what the hell, that's no big deal. How would you like it to happen to you or someone you know or love? And how would you like to know that there are people... other governments or, you know, like insurgent groups that did that to American soldiers. Oh, all we did to a soldier from Michigan was to strip him naked, put a hood over his head, not let him go to sleep, and, like that. Anyway, they didn't even mention waterboarding here. Tom Ridge, who was the first...
remember him.
The Ministry of Homeland Security. Yeah, the guy that had all the red and... alerts.
Oh, you remember those? Yeah, the orange, red, yellow, green.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to those?
Well, guess they're still there.
They were the focus of everything, remember?
Guess what? Tom Ridge said waterboarding is torture. And you were starting to bring this up. Living in fear and paying a high cost and heart risk.
Oh, I thought this was terrifying, actually. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Basically, it's a as they call it, an intriguing new study. I find it frightening. The answer is, okay, here we go. La, la, la. The pain that terrorist attacks inflict on victims and society. Wait, I got to get to the point, Peter.
Oh, once you, there's a point. I think that's called the beginning.
Worrying about... Thanks a lot.
Actually, read the first sentence.
Okay, which is more of a threat to your health, Al-Qaeda or the Department of Homeland Security? You're right.
Yeah.
But the part that struck me was worrying about terrorism could be taking a toll on the hearts of millions of Americans. The evidence published last week tracks the health of a representative sample of more than 2,700 Americans. After the attacks of September 11th, the scientists monitored people's fears over the next several years, found the most fearful people were 3 to 5 times more likely than the rest to receive diagnoses of new cardiovascular ailments.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought there was another interesting...
So the fear is killing people.
Yeah. When statisticians look at cold numbers, they have variously estimated the chances of the average person dying in America at the hands of international terrorists to be comparable to a risk of dying from eating peanuts, being struck by an asteroid, or drowning in a toilet.
Okay, another interesting part there.
Yeah. Now, yeah. I was supposed to fly to Washington on, my wife and I were going to go to Washington on something like September, I'm trying to think, like 21st, 10 days after. And she said, "We're not going, are you? Are we?" And I said, "Yeah, of course. Not going to happen again."
Right.
And she was like really scared. And I didn't think it would happen again. So I was all set to go. And so I guess I'm going to.
I flew right after.
Yeah. Worrying about terrorism could be taking a toll on the heart. Yeah. The evidence published where there was something. Almost all the people in the study lived outside of New York or Washington, didn't know any victims of the September 11th attacks, but more than 10% of them reported acute stress symptoms like insomnia or nightmares right after the attacks. And over the next 3 years, more than 40% said they kept worrying about a terrorist attack affecting them or a family member. Now, these aren't just... I mean, this may be a focal point for their... the anxieties that people have, but it was induced greatly by Bushco.
Yeah,
this was perfect,
right.
Purposely that round late 2001, 2002, because it was ramping up all these wars,
yeah.
And it was Bushco's intent to scare the crap out of
the fear tactic.
These people were horrible.
So
they've killed more Americans than just have died in Iraq.
That's true.
Or that died on September 11th. Their worries were understandable. Go here, even in this article. Given the continual warnings from Washington, officials repeatedly raised the color-coded level of the National Threat Advisory and sometimes explicitly warned of imminent attacks from terrorist cells supposedly operating in America. Remember, they were saying they're going to hit bridges, and they were...
Yes.
The alert level has never dropped below yellow, the third of the five levels. About a third to a half of Americans continue to tell pollsters they are personally worried about being victims of a terrorist attack, and that attack is somewhat or very likely within the next several months. Now, I'm not saying that I'm surprised that one hasn't happened.
Well, that was one of your predictions.
Yeah. Well, it's not... The elections haven't. I mean, I so want to be wrong on that.
Oh, absolutely.
But, as we've seen around the world, that Al-Qaeda, which is in many ways a construction or a fiction of the Bushco as a coherent unit. I mean, they have coordinated activities. But, I mean, we're talking on September 11th, box cutters and people willing to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what we've seen are the people that have done great damage in London and in Madrid and in Bali, where hundreds and hundreds of people have been killed, these are freelancers. These are people that have been so pissed off by what Bushco has done around in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world that they're freebooting. And the idea that that someone wouldn't do that here, I think, is just wishful thinking. But you know what? I keep wishing and thinking and hoping that I'm wrong.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we got to take a break. We'll get your calls right after these. Pardon me. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And call talkyes@yahoo.com. We're right back.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Remember the Territory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station, 101 WRIM. Everything that rocks. WRIM.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Joined by Jalene Jordan. Thank you for being here, Jalene. Thanks to all of you for calling 313-298-WRIF. And actually, I should say, first and foremost, hey, Jalene, thank you for listening. I meet people, and they often say, I listen to your show every Sunday. And I say, oh, thanks. And they guiltily say, well, I never call, though. And I forget what I've heard as high as 2% and as low as 0.5% of the audience actually
calls. And that's okay. If you just want to listen.
Yeah, that's fine.
If you want to call.
For one thing, I haven't even thought about this. Probably when we're really rolling and we're not tonight, we maybe take 20 calls.
Right.
Well, if that was 2% of the audience, I told you, you said don't challenge you with math.
No math. Maybe I should just bring a calculator.
20 is...
No, la, 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 la.
2% is 20%. I can't even formulate the question. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, we are here GMT minus 5.
Yes.
Right, we know that.
We do now know that.
Greenwich Mean Time. And I'll be interviewing at 1 a.m. If you're elsewhere, you do the math and figure it out. The first guest will be Jeff Cohn. He's the author of Cable News Confidential. And he and Scott Ritter, the ex-Marine, ex-UN weapons inspector, will be in Detroit speaking January 26th. I would highly recommend this.
That would be a Saturday?
Next Saturday, yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. I'm sorry. I thought I had an error here. But, yeah, if this is all on my website, Peter Werby. W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. And Pam, I believe, let me just real quickly switch screens here. Yeah, it's Pam from Ypsilanti who takes part in the weekly anti-war vigils there at noon in Ypsilanti. And she said, typo on your calendar. And I've asked her and others. I said, who's ever there? Whenever you see bad links, you see typos. Yeah. And I have a vigil listed. And it's been there probably for 6 months, an anti-war vigil that I said takes place at 11 p.m. Well, it's not 11 p.m. It's 11 a.m.
Feel free to correct.
Yeah, so, yeah, we'd like that. My website is peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, peterwerbe.com. And, also with the guest, graphic novelist, Rick Geary, used to do cartoons for Heavy Metal and, DC Comics.
Oh, way cool.
He's created a graphic biography, which means a comic biography of J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI
director. Oh, no. Now, I mean, oh, yes.
Now, I've always said, now, this is interesting. This is interesting. And I'm not even going to tell you, Jalene.
I already know this.
Well, I asked him, is it true that the J. Edgar Hoover FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., that we've been right in front of.
The only building named after a crossdresser.
After a transvestite. I said, was in fact J. Edgar Hoover a transvestite, a crossdresser? But we say, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Oh, no. Do your thing, whatever it is.
Yeah, but if you're a whack job that like Hoover was, that tries to...
That had nothing to do with the clothing.
Yeah, right. But that tries to, was so authoritarian and so repressive and made Bush look like an ACLU attorney.
Oh, my.
I mean, Hoover was...
Now, that's bad.
Yeah, was so repressive of civil liberties. So that's interesting. But there's also other things of interest at peterwerbe.com. Remember Mission Accomplished? Well, there's a little video there that says Bushco wants to erase it from our memories. Check out how they alter the past. George Orwell's 1984 Ministry of Truth couldn't have done it any better.
Ooh.
Also, there's a Bush to order new coins minted, old money to be confiscated.
Okay.
Yeah, you may take that one with a grain of salt. But it's, again, last name is W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. I'm selling nothing. So, you know.
That's true.
Yeah, right. All right, let's go back to our phones and say thank you to Delmar in New Boston for waiting so patiently. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. One of the things so many people look at it is the government needs to get us out of this. The individuals, every time they make a purchase, needs to get us out of the problems. I mean, every time you buy something from Taiwan or Korea or India, China, you're sending money over to these other countries, and then we become in competition with them for gasoline, metals, everything else we want in life. And
here's the problem that I've said before, Delmar. In fact, I've told a little story about a friend of mine's father who was a union chief, and he'd walk in like to take out his daughter or something like that, and he'd grab you by the shirt. He thought he was going to throw you out or something, but he was looking to make sure that the label on your shirt said, made in the USA and hopefully even union made, but he'd settle for made in the USA. Well,
it's tough to find, first of all.
I'll bet you I do not have a pair of, I bet you I don't have a single item on my body that's made in the United States.
It gets hard to do that, and it's only going to get harder. When people complain about the price of gasoline, 20 years ago, they didn't sell 5 million cars in India.
Right.
Okay, that 5 million cars that are $2,500 a piece or whatever they're making them for in India now, they're using gasoline. There's only so much gasoline to go around. We're in competition now with those millions and millions of gallons. That it's strawberries in February. We were the only ones that ate them 20 years ago. Now the rest of the world's got the appetite for it.
Sure.
It's
interesting. I just do this because I don't support Ron Paul, but so I love to quote him. But Ron Paul, as I said earlier, part of his program is to bring home 700 to 800 of the military bases, all the personnel, cut the military budget. I don't know if he uses the figure, but other people have said cut the military budget by 3/4. Stop this from being a military-industrial complex. Get rid of the World Trade Organization regulations. Get rid of NAFTA. Don't make any more of these hemispherical trade agreements. And use some of that money that was saved. There'd be enough money saved there that we could probably, at a minimum, have my $50,000 tax deduction right off the bat. That we could begin a crash program that we could get off of oil probably in 5 to 10 years. I mean, the technology is already there. We just have to stop using oil because it's killing us. And Bush goes over there, as we were reading from that article earlier, and these companies go over to Saudi Arabia or China with their hat in their hand saying, will you please buy up our economy? Right?
Personally, though, when you look at the environmental impact, of even if the rest of the world uses the gasoline, you're not going to get India to change their mind and pay $35,000 for a car when they get one for $2,500,
right,
because it'll get three times the gas mileage.
Sure.
You know what I mean? That's not going to happen.
The Tata, as it's called. And we might as well say
the name of the car.
Well, yes. Yeah. 10 feet long, 5 foot wide. I think it's 50 miles a gallon. But it's like Tata for now to the environment, because you're absolutely right, Delmar, is that the impact of putting tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even more, like millions of more vehicles on the planet, and having national economies competing for what's left of once we've reached peak oil, if we haven't reached there, as it is, it's going to be a nightmare. It's going to be. I mean, this is going to be the good old days. We
can afford that is because they make a toy for every one of our Happy Meals.
There you go.
You know what I mean? If we didn't need a toy for every Happy Meal, a plastic hat for every holiday, and a made-in-China American flag for Memorial Day, we wouldn't be in competition with those people.
Well, Delmar, the problem is, one of the many problems, is that it's the nature of capitalism. It has to always expand its productive and consumption process and stasis, remaining stable, kills the system. So there's got to be some way to work on this so that we can get a sustainable, stable economy, because it's killing the environment. And I mean, I have a pack of papers here that I've been trying to bring up. Some of them go back to like October, that because of the war, because of the economy, because of a million other assaults on us that I never get around to. But thank you for bringing that up. I appreciate that. 313-298-WRIF.
I have a very basic suggestion, though, when you talk about your clothing. I would Google fair trade clothing, fair trade goods, and buy local and really research. Yeah. Do your best.
There is. Isn't there a women's line called American Made or something?
Oh, there is.
From
there
L.A.?
Is, yeah.
What's the name of it?
I think it's called American Made, and there's one in
Royal Oak,
Michigan.
Yeah.
There, yeah.
Yeah. And, but
or American Apparel or something
and,
like that.
You know, I actually saw a Ford 150, one of those big trucks, with a sign on it that said, Japanese cars suck. And this was a Ford product. And one of the things, I'm about to write a letter to the Ford Customer Relations Department about this Ford I have. I mean, I'm thinking, I so wish I had a Japanese car. I mean, I have one. I know. I had an Altima. But it was probably
Don't hate me.
I was here. It was made in the United States, wasn't it?
It was, actually.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
I had an Altima in the late 90s. And then when you and I went to work for the UAW,
yes,
with our nationally syndicated talk show, I thought, man, I better get
Buy American,
or I couldn't even park in the UAW
parking lot. I had to park across the street. I got in trouble with the president of the entire UAW.
The big boss.
Steaming mad at me.
Didn't I defend you?
Of course you did.
Yeah, I did. And they said, oh, you shouldn't talk back to him. I said, why do you talk back to him? What the hell? You know, the only people I don't talk back to are people that got a gun on me.
That's right. Or your wife.
Yeah. But baby. Baby. Hey, wait. Ho. Wait. Let me talk. Wait. How do these polygamists do it?
Oh, I don't know. Don't even get me started.
All right.
Polyamory, maybe. Polygamy, no.
Moving on.
Moving right along here.
Oh, man. Nick, so I'm sorry I kept you waiting a long time, and you're driving. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Well, thanks for having me. Going back to a while back, we're talking about the economy and what the war is doing to the people at home. What I was saying earlier, what a lot of people are seeming to skip over, more and more, is not just the middle class, but the students of the middle class families. I mean, I myself am a student right now. I'm working, two jobs just to try and pay my way through college. I mean, I'm still paying just as much taxes as everyone else out of you know, what I earn at work. And it's just like, we talk about tax breaks for the wealthy and, you know, what about for the people who need it? But out of everything, I think there should be something for students. I mean, it's really ridiculous. You're working two jobs trying to afford tuition.
What is two? Where are you going? Where are you going to school, Nick?
Right now, I'm just over at Schoolcraft because Schoolcraft College, Sabonius Community College.
Well, not to say just.
No, that's a great school.
Yeah, don't say just.
It's a very good school. Yeah. I mean, and it's really, really cheap, too. So that's a real big plus. For my situation right now.
Well, here, how about this? What I was, I'm going to keep hitting this one note. If we were to slice, let me start off with Ron Paul's thing. You get rid of 700-800 bases around the United States, dismantle all of that. We should have free college tuition, period. If someone said you had to pay for high school, people would say, you're crazy. Well, why do you have to pay for college? I mean, everybody says it's important for the individual. It's important for job skills. It's important
for Sally Mae.
Yeah, it's important.
Well, it's a loan company.
Yeah, it's important for the it's important for the economy. And yet we charge people through the nose. One of the things that they found out recently, Nick, is that these schools, even some big prestigious ones, keep raising their tuition rates beyond inflation and beyond what actually the news of the school, the needs of the schools are, that they're just trying to create these enormous endowment funds. So yeah, free tuition. Go ahead.
Well, we spend, it was like in a documentary that we as Americans spend more money on, personally, out of our own pockets, more money on our scholastic systems, and it's still not the best in the world. I mean, some of the scholastic systems like Mexico, I believe has a better system. I don't know about the education, but they have a better system than we do. Look at China. China's got one of the best educational systems in the world.
Sure.
Europe has a very, very good educational system. And I actually have a friend studying in Germany. It only cost her $500 for one semester at one of their most prestigious universities.
Wow.
I was blown away. I was like,
yeah, what? Well, families and or the student are just going in hock and wind up debtors again.
Yes.
And it's criminal that someone like Nick has to work two jobs.
It is, Nick. I mean, how are you expected to go to class, absorb it, study, and work? And
it's really difficult. But it's just like... I'm not the only one doing it.
No, that's for sure.
Right, right.
Nick, thank you so much for calling.
And good luck.
Yes. 313-298-WRIF, Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. And let's go to Detroit and talk to Maurice. Maurice, it's Peter and Jolene. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
We're doing great.
You know, Peter, I just came up with an idea. I might be wrong. I know why the state of Michigan is in the shape it is in.
How come?
The reason we got a woman governor, a lot of people around the world, the cultures believe that women are inferior to men. A lot of people would not want to come to Detroit and to Michigan to do business. Now, if we have a woman president, that would be a bigger issue that a lot of people would not sit down and negotiate with Hillary Clinton.
So you're saying it's perceptual that you think that the reason that all of these manufacturing facilities over the last 20 years, it wasn't all during the time of Jennifer Granholm, but that they say, whoa, that a woman can't do the job. Well, I don't know.
My God.
All right, you listen on your radio. I think we're going to have an answer here. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But
all I have to say.
Margaret Thatcher? Well, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
For real?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm speechless once again this week. This is the second time this has happened in 2 weeks, Peter.
Maurice, I got to tell you, it's dumb.
And we like Maurice. He calls us. We like you, Maurice.
Yeah, you've been calling. Maurice's been calling for more years than
Maurice,
I can remember.
Maurice, how can you do me like this?
Yeah, you know, that was dumb. That was dumb. How about this? I mean, this is absolute. I mean, this system is so corrupt. Let me see. I got two stories of the same thing. I mean, well, maybe this will make more impact on the more patriotic. This is from the Military Times. Retired Army General Tommy Franks was paid $100,000 out of donations made to wounded veterans for allowing his name to be used on fundraising appeals by a charity that has come under increasing scrutiny for the way it handles its money. So it says the same thing here in this from the Washington Post. At a raucous three-hour hearing yesterday, House members questioned California entrepreneur, an entrepreneur no less, Robert Chapin, about his management of two charities. One charity, Help Hospitalized Veterans, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations that were to help wounded soldiers on personal expenses for Chapin, Executive Director Mike Lynch, and Richard A. Vigory. Now, Vigory is this far right-wing guy that was into all this direct mail stuff, so he's like a Reaganite, to whom the charity has awarded millions of dollars in fundraising consulting contracts. So, one of these articles was sent to me by Stephen, who said, I still don't understand why a vet should need to turn to a charity for help. A government that sends them off to war should have already compensated them and continued to care for them when needed. So think about this, and I wonder if any of you have contributed to any of these vet charities. Now, some of them do what they're supposed to.
Extremely legitimate.
Yeah, but how the hell do you know? How do you sort through it?
True.
That's the problem. The expenses. Now, here, people contributed their money, and I'll bet you, I'll bet you the people that contributed the most are people that are in the class of people that either were in the service or have neighbors that were in the service, which generally means mostly the upper working class, the lower middle class. Because you start getting into the middle class and the upper middle class and the upper class, they don't send anybody off the Army. To the service
right,
at all.
Right.
So it's probably the people that had the most empathy and the most compassion that sent their money, and these right wingers spent stuff on like $340,000 for meals, hotels and entertainment, $135,000 loan to one of the officers for a divorce settlement with his former wife.
What?
$17,000 country club membership, three airplane tickets to Hawaii, and $1 million loan to Vigory, this for a startup initiative at his firm.
And meanwhile, these young men and women are over there for an illegal war.
Yeah.
And dying for this kind of crap right here.
Now,
right here.
General Tommy Franks, I'm losing this. Is he from which war? Is he from the Gulf War, or is he from this one? Who is the big...
He was in this one, I believe.
This one,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
He's the guy that said, we don't do civilian body counts?
Yeah.
So he allowed himself to get paid $100,000.
Of course he did.
What a scumbag.
Allowed himself.
What a total scumbag.
Yeah, really.
I mean,
and that's putting it nicely because we're on the air.
Yeah, I do stuff like, if you've listened at all to WRIF around Christmas time,
yeah,
I voiced all those commercials for Gleaners.
Yes, the food bank.
And I didn't get paid a penny.
And you wouldn't want to.
I wouldn't have accepted.
No way.
Right, because what that would have meant is that you would have contributed to Gleaners, and instead of it going to feed a poor person in the Detroit area.
Like if a couple of families, they would have had to pay you.
They would have had to pay me.
Yeah, well, that just...
Tommy Franks, you're a scumbag.
Yes.
God.
And I want to say more, but I'm just going to stop.
Yeah, right. We have careers.
Yes, we do.
We want to be
and we have filters.
Yeah, yeah.
Personal filters.
I'm not going to tell him what... I shouldn't even say this. Never mind. All right. Here's Jim and Romulus. Jim, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you I listen to your show every night, and I am one of the 2% that I almost was going to hang up, and I'm glad I didn't. Anyway, my common-law wife, she worked for Farmer Jack's for 34 years, so she's out of work.
Yeah.
And the good thing about that her pension was federally funded.
Oh, that's good.
So that's good. And then I'm laid off, of course. But right now, as we speak, I am sitting in a guard check. I've just found a job as of 2:08 as a security guard. I mean, it's $9 an hour, but...
But we're glad you're working.
It's like gold. You know, it's been godsend to me.
So you're one of the 2% of what?
Of the callers. Remember you were
guys. Okay.
I thought you meant the Hell's Angels, 1% or something like that. No, that's good. Well, we're glad you found something, but it's really a disgrace that you know, what?
Yeah, but he's given me 12 hours. I do 7 p.m. to 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And it's not so bad. I check in trucks and stuff all night long. And I was wondering about that rebate. If, you know, you said something about the lower class people or the middle class. I forget exactly.
Well,
what
it's the poor who don't pay Social Security.
The working poor. So if you're making $18,000 a year from your job, well, if you're making, how many?
I was doing temp services, Peter.
Yeah.
Temp services, that's how rough it's been, and I'm sure all these other listeners out there will vouch for me.
Yeah, I've done
sure.
that. I've done that.
it's rough, so I'm just wondering if me and my common-law wife, Cynthia, are going to qualify for that.
You know, I have to say, I really don't know.
Don't know, but...
Yeah, they're...
But we will say, Peter and I will agree, you're the ones who deserve it!
Yeah.
Well, yes. You know, like, I made probably $5,000 in 2007. Well, 2008 is doing a turnaround now. This job here is about $25,000 a year, believe it or not, at $9 an hour.
Oh, because a lot of overtime.
Because of the hours, correct.
Yeah, because you're working your ass off. That's
yeah.
What it is.
Actually, no, I'm not. I'm sitting in front of a little...
You're sitting on your ass.
Yeah.
In a guard check, and I checked in trucks all night.
But 12 hours a day is too much.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was telling this a couple of weeks ago. In the 1880s, the Chicago police were shooting workers down in the street because they were demanding the eight-hour day. I mean, that's 120-something years ago that this occurred, because when workers had the temerity to organize and say from the bosses and demand of the bosses and the rulers that the day be officially an eight-hour day. Well, at some point, there was discussion about a six-hour day. Why shouldn't there be? Why? I mean, 12-hour days, this is like, and I'm not I'm certainly not critical of you in the slightest.
Because you're doing what you have to do.
Yeah, you're doing what you
bills,
have to do.
And that's much respect from us.
It makes me angry that you're forced to do that, because you should be working about six, and all of us should be working about 6 hours a day. Of course, you know, I had a boss one time at the UAW that said to me with the talk show that, he says, well, you only work 3 hours a day. That was the length of Jolene and my show, which is the closest I ever came to violence, because I was working 12-hour days.
For real, yeah. Doing that show.
God, yeah. That's right. Okay. All right. Well, best of luck on it, and you can only hope things get better. And I hope you get that that money. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you do, let us know.
Yeah. That's when, you know, some of you very kindly write me and say, that, gee, well, I wish you had a daily show again. I don't.
Oh, come on, Peter.
Ugh.
Bring it on.
Bring it on.
Needs us.
I'm doing fine.
If I may say so.
I'm doing fine. All right, let's go south. Go to Rick, who is in Harrow, Ontario, our neighbor from the south. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you tonight?
We're doing good. You understand why I'm saying the south, right?
Yes, because we're about 30 miles south from Detroit.
Yeah.
Over here,
because people are probably listening around the world and other parts of this country on our stream and thinking, wait a minute, how can Detroit be north of Canada? Well,
yeah, Detroit is about 3 miles north of where I'm at.
Yeah.
I'm on the north shore of Lake Erie.
I know exactly where you are.
Oh, perfect.
Nice little town.
What's on your mind there, Rick?
Oh, you want to hear my stories about how I bicycled through Harrow?
Oh, you have?
I have bicycled through Harrow, yeah.
Oh, perfect.
They're all around, Leamington
and Kingsville and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, right. Colchester.
Maybe you two should have lunch. Talk
about Martin Luther King holiday this weekend.
Right.
And I'd like to say, to everybody, everyone relax and have a good time and stuff like that. Dr. Martin Luther King, he was speaking before his passing there about freedom and equality for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear about freedom amongst everybody, and there's a couple of things that comes before freedom. And it's more like equality, that equality amongst people brings
sure.
peace and then freedom. And so when everyone's talking about, fighting and going overseas and stuff like that, fighting about freedom, it's jumping over the fact of equality amongst people and peace before you bring freedom. You know what I'm trying to say there?
Oh, well, I do indeed. And, well, when the, you know, the President of the United States says it, or when the now, you know, when the Prime Minister of Canada says it, it's just empty rhetoric. No, you're absolutely right. Does Canada at all, they don't have...
No, there's no holiday for Martin Luther King Day here, but everyone celebrates it anyhow.
Really? Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
I do, anyways.
Well, you got you got to just
down here and stuff.
Right.
It's very important for everybody.
But, well, Stephen Harper, your prime minister, is just bound and determined to make a warrior state of Canada, and you know, with increased military expenditures, he wants to build all those ships to patrol the opening waters, you know, up in the
north, and everyone trying to take over the Arctic Passage and stuff.
Yeah, which what I say is, in fact, well, let me see. You may be a little more sympathetic to this than others, but most of us have military in our minds as a cultural, given. And that is, I've said on this show, that Canada should not even bother to have an army. The only country that is going to invade Canada, you're talking to some people that live in it, and the only country that would have any reason to. And so Canada essentially has an army so it can tag along on things like the U.S. war in Afghanistan. And you guys would be much better served if you took the money, the hundreds of billions of dollars, and bolster, for instance, your medical system. What do you think?
Well, as far as the conservative government's concerned, I'm not one to... be behind them whatsoever. They used to be called the Progressive Conservatives,
right,
which some of the comics used to call the Stop Go Party.
Stop Go Party.
But
it always confused me. But I,
Progressive Conservatives.
Yeah. Progressive Conservatives. So
right.
It was Stop Go. But
yeah. All right. Well, thanks for making our show international, Rick. Appreciate you calling in from Harrow, Ontario. Thanks a lot. Harrow. That's all in Essex County.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and Michigan loops, including Detroit, loops over the top of Essex County. Got to take a look on the map.
You know, there's always even a little geography lesson with you, Peter, on Sunday nights.
Yeah.
Really, I really do learn.
You know where
I'm just a sponge.
Essex County looks like kind of like the United States with this, like Florida at the bottom, with,
yeah,
and is Point Pelee Provincial Park, which is an internationally known birdwatching area and nature place. Very, very, and beaches. It's a wonderful spot. And at the tip, they used to have a trash barrel that said Canada's southernmost trash barrel.
Just like Key West, the southernmost point.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
do. Yeah.
Here's John in Clinton Township. John, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
We're good.
Hey, I did want to say one thing I do agree with you guys on is this foreign trade policy, how it's really screwing over everybody, especially in this town.
Yeah.
We're sending all our jobs overseas. I mean, we used to be the industrial leader of basically the world at one point in time, and now we're producing jack squat, and it's really starting to get on my nerves.
And
know?
Borrowing money from these countries at an alarming rate.
Yeah, I know that, but it's kind of hard out here. You know, I was in the service. I injured my knee, and I'm kind of disabled. I get $500 a month, and that doesn't even cover all the rent, and I'm out of work because I'm a construction worker, and this is just really getting out of hand. You know, it's everybody's getting screwed here, and there really needs to be something to be done about this.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and when I hear people like yourself and who was it, the security guard, this is not the way things have to be. I mean, there's enough wealth in the world, there's enough resources in the world that people don't have to be suffering this, and people that have...
They shouldn't be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, well, thank you very much. We have to go to a break. I appreciate it. I hope things
improve.
Best
of luck to you, yes.
Yeah. You know, is this what's going to come down to? Well, let me tell you this, folks. I mean, the kind of genuineness that I think comes from Jolene is from me as well, about wishing people well, wishing people good luck. But understand that it's at that level. It's we're wishing him good luck. It's like going into an operation and saying, you know, good luck. I hope you survive.
Yeah, or it's like you're going to a track meet. Okay, yeah. Good luck.
Well, and not even that. So what I meant is that there should be, I think earlier I didn't really get to the end of what I was even thinking, is that when I said about either we have to create a movement of renewal and resistance first, then renewal, or Thatcher, admit we're peasants and Thatcher roofs.
Yeah.
And so most people are saying, so how do I join the movement of resistance and renewal? There's little things going on. There's meetings. There's all sorts of protests. There's rallies that if you're working in unions, you can take more of a part in that. There's small things now, but there's nothing present. There's nothing that I can suggest that either you or me show up at tomorrow. I mean, there is. There's the Martin Luther King rally and demonstration.
You can go to Woodward and Night Mile.
Yeah. Well,
4:45.
Tomorrow, yeah. Or at noon downtown at Grand Circus? Yeah. Grand Circus Park at Central Methodist Church.
Right.
These are still little tentative steps. I mean, we're talking about we have to create something as large as the American Revolution, as large as the abolitionist movement, as large as the union movement of the 1930s. Or we're, you know, and because the people that run things and that are ripping us off and looting us and destroying the potential of our lives, there's one thing they're looking at is how do we respond? How do we respond? And if we don't do anything, if we just complain about it, well, they're going to keep digging into us deeper and deeper. And how we can respond hasn't been formulated yet. But if we stand by and become only observers in this era, it would be like doing that in the 1930s or the 1960s or other periods of American history when people took charge. We didn't depend on politicians. We didn't care about Ron Paul or Dennis Kucinich or Hillary or Huckabee or anybody like that.
Or the ghoul.
The ghoul. I don't want a president Huckabee. Excuse me if anybody else has got that name out there.
Oh, no. It's not about his name. It's about his favorite book that he carries with him on is his Bible.
Yeah. Speaking of the ghoul, what was his theme song? Not Giuliani, but the real ghoul.
Oh, the real ghoul?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Power to the people.
Ah! You know, I didn't live here then, but I know.
Yeah.
The ghoul. Met him.
We're going to be right back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I got to turn on my mic, don't I? Jillian Jordan is with me. It looks like you're ready to go. You got her coat on?
It's cold in here. I mean, it's just so cold outside. I just, yeah. You know.
Wonder if we hit 2 below. Yeah, it doesn't say on the screen. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, I'll be interviewing Jeff Cohn, author of Cable News Confidential. He had a show on Fox News.
He was not a conservative on Fox News.
And they booted him out of there. And then he was the producer for, what's...
He did...
what's that guy's name?
Was it Sam Cedar?
No. that liberal talk show host on MSNBC...
Donahue. Keith Olbermann?
Donahue.
Oh, Phil remember Donahue. That short lived program. You know that's how you're supposed to say it?
Lived?
Yeah. It's short lived, not short lived.
Let's move on.
I'm on a roll tonight, aren't I? And I can't wait to see these emails.
The producer of that, and he talks about how at the run-up to the Iraq War, that even though Phil Donahue had the best ratings on MSNBC, they just booted him out. They didn't want to contradict Bush Cove policy. Jeff Cohn and ex-UN weapons inspector, ex-Marine Scott Ritter is going to be in Detroit on January 26th. You can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, find the information. Also, graphic novelist Rick Geary, creator of J. Edgar Hoover, a graphic biography.
Yeah, if you can see Scott Ritter, go do it.
Yeah. I've interviewed him a couple of times. Now, this from Olu Finland, from our friend Jacob, who writes, the demand for the locally designed, that is in India, Tata Nano, small car in India, is 75 million cars. Remember I said a few million?
Oh, my gosh.
Jacob, you got to be wrong about this. He says the car will cost 2,500 rupees, which is about $65 for the U.S.
I think you're in denial. I think you're telling him he's wrong because you just can't fathom those numbers.
Well, I can't believe it's $65.
It's possible.
$65.
Oh, okay.
The Indian population is now over 1 billion. And what happens if every Indian family started running 22 cars, like we expect here, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Dave writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. This is a little of what we were talking about. He says, I was wondering about your opinion on the lack of interest among the public, the apathy. I was in a local diner talking to some fellow citizens, and politics came up as we were talking. I realized that the more we talked, the more passionate the conversation became until we got to the line that no one wants to cross to actually do something about it. I feel this is a strong issue that needs to be addressed.
Agreed.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. I mean, the reason that people are apathetic is that there's not any realistic sense that anything could be done.
Yeah.
Because I would, how soon we forget, the writer that just wrote, what was his name? What did I say?
Scott Ritter?
No, the one who just wrote the letter.
Oh, Dave?
Dave, yeah. That he may not be doing anything. Either. And I don't know. I mean, I do some political work, but not a great amount.
Right. I think this is my political work. Absolutely. And also, I think, you know, everywhere you go, you can... I mean, I was just having this conversation the other night, the ripple effect that we talk about. Just talking about it with people and opening up their mind to new ideas is something.
It's a way to start.
It is.
For sure.
So don't be discouraged. Keep talking.
Here's Alan Ferndale. Peter and Jolene, you're on WRIF with us. Go ahead.
How you doing, Jolene?
Hi, Al.
Peter, how you doing? Good night so far.
Well, thank you. What's up?
For starters, I want to thank Jolene for getting that number for me for U of M.
Dental care, remember?
Oh, yeah. You're the vet.
Al was in Vietnam and can't get dental care, so I hope they can help you out.
Sure.
Thank you for that, and the caller that gave you the number.
That's right.
I do have a USA T-shirt on. Made in USA.
Oh, you do?
Oh, made in the well, good. I don't know. Maybe
amazing.
I do. Maybe I doubt it. I could have. You want to come over here and look at my labels?
Sure, Peter.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I gotta know.
You gotta know?
Gotta know.
Okay. I got like about 3 shirts on or something like that.
Are you cold in there?
Yeah.
Made in the USA.
All right. Yay! USA. USA. Woo! USA. Yeah. There we go.
You're the man. You're the man.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, Frank.
Yeah.
Scumbag.
Who, Tommy Franks? Tommy, he's talking about Tommy Franks.
Tommy Franks, beyond scumbag.
Yeah.
The reason I'm saying that is I get a yearly raise on my VA disability as well as everybody, every other vet that has a disability check coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And Social Security as well. My mom gets one. I just want to throw this out there. You're probably aware of it, but everybody, the VA, Social Security people that get these checks every year, they get a raise in January.
Right.
I got a raise this year, $15.
Wow.
Last year, it was $32.
The $15 won't even deal with inflation.
I can't buy a pair of shoelaces for that.
Yeah, you could. But shoelace, I bought a pair of shoelaces. I mean, I thought it'd be like 40 cents. It was like $5 or something.
So that he can buy a couple pair. Well, happy new year to you, Al.
Okay, Al. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, really appreciate it. I want to talk to Frank in Ann Arbor about something I've been meaning to bring up since last week. Frank, hi. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It's the national ID card that Bush said he wouldn't give us. And the Republicans snuck it in the middle of the night.
Right.
Because they knew that the Democrats wouldn't vote against the spending bill for Iraq soldiers. And anyways, they can tell who you are just by passing by you. And it's got a lot of, and if you're a state that doesn't comply, there's a lot of loops you got to go through. And basically, you won't be able to travel from state to a state that doesn't have it. Without some sort of, there's some type of a card you have to get there.
You know what? I think there are a lot of problems. I don't want to have this this national ID standard set up by the federal government under the Department of Homeland Security, Frank. But it's not. For one thing, they don't have a readable card. It's not like the cops can go by you and, you know, flash some sort of reader.
That's right. It's more about flying.
Yeah, it has more to do with flying, and you could certainly go from state to state. But you're right. It's what they call an unfunded mandate. In other words, that this is going to cost the state money after they've been ordered to do this by the federal government, but because of federal legislation, federal statute. But the federal government hasn't produced or is not providing funds for it. So, the state lawmakers complain that these requirements add up to a national identification card that they say is too costly, that it puts our privacy at risk, and there's a lot of technical challenges to it as well. But thank you for bringing that up. I appreciate it. But we are heading, in any event, and I'll sound like one of these right-wing conspiracy nuts, but sort of a cashless world.
Is that possible?
No, not really.
Okay.
But there is the totally administered society, and instead of cash, we'll have sort of a universal producer consumer card. I mean, as it is, and I think I've talked about this before, is I don't deal with cash very much. I get my check here, direct deposit. I charge almost everything. And then at the end of the month,
you pay it off.
My wife writes a check.
Yes.
And so I put $40-$50 in my pocket. And sometimes I go the whole week and never spend it. You know,
right.
When I go out to dinner with my handball buddies, after we play ball then that's the only few other things.
Yeah, you've bought breakfast for me before, but of course.
Oh, that's the same thing. Usually eating.
Yeah. It's
but
food involved.
The hardware store.
Right.
Go up and get some drywall screws.
Right.
A manly man thing to do.
You are so manly.
Yeah, I'm manly. I am. It's true. Let's go to Steve. Steve, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us. Where are you calling from?
Calling actually from Algonac, Michigan.
Yeah.
Oh, hello.
Hello, hello. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How are you guys doing? I just wanted to bring up, I think one of the main issues that is going to be prevalent, at least on my end, that I'm looking for is decentralization of government, giving power right back to the actual people and taking it out of Capitol Hill.
Sure.
One of the things that, I mean, even Thomas Jefferson said that a government big enough to supply everything you need is also big enough to take everything you have.
Hmm.
The course of history shows that as government grows, liberty decreases. And, I mean, with such things like the Patriot Act, I mean, it's super easy to see that we're entering a system of complete control from our government end. And I think the next candidate should definitely make a big event out of decentralization of government to get us back into a place where our economy can flourish and we're not reliant on corporate bigwigs to make decisions for us that we never even see.
Well, I don't think, yeah, as I was saying, I don't think that's really in the cards. We'd have to make it happen. I mean, if we are depending on one of these mainstream candidates in either party, it certainly isn't. I don't know if you heard what I said about the future with having a cashless world and a universal producer-consumer card. That goes in the opposite direction. I mean, look, as I was saying earlier, government arose as a racket, and it, for almost all of its time on the earth, has functioned like that. If you think about it, probably 98, 99% of all governments that have ever existed have been tyrannical, haven't they?
At some point, I think there's corruption that comes with it, too. But with a proper check and balance system, which if you read the original Constitution before it was even modified, they definitely warn of checks and balances as being the only thing that we have. And coming out of the Revolutionary War, they really wanted to put in a place that we could not end up under that tyranny before. And as America, we were kind of the guiding nation, the first one to really have that written in. And I think that that's been slowly and surely taken away.
Yeah, it has. And, we were the first government ever to have such an extensive written document that laid out exactly what governments could and couldn't do. And it's an incredible document. And, of course, the government of the United States almost immediately started to violate its principles. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here's John. John is on the road. Hi. You're on the air.
How are you doing, Peter?
We're doing great.
I got some problems with the EPA and fuel mileage of cars. I mean, going back to 1981, I was driving a Datsun. Remember those Datsun, a V210 hatchback?
Sure. I had one of those.
You remember Dr. Datsun?
That I do not.
Okay,
me neither.
Go ahead.
Well, anyway, that car gave me 44 miles to the gallon on the freeway.
Really?
That was through a regular gas carbureted engine, and now with the fuel emissions and everything else, we've got computerized engines, we've got fuel injection systems. We should be able to far surpass the economy given us by an antiquated carbureted engine of yesteryear. But the government keeps on putting on more and more EPA restrictions on how much pollution a car can put out, which chokes down the fuel economy.
Well, it may, but it also the opposite is to choke down us, the population, eh?
But just follow me here for a minute.
Go ahead.
If Americans didn't keep on driving these large SUVs, you could put three Datsun V210 hatchbacks on the road for the size of one Cadillac Escalade or one pickup truck or one full-size SUV.
Sure. Well, what happens is, I drive a full-size sedan, and the reason I do it is because whenever I drive in some, smaller cars called? You know,
economy?
Economy class cars, I'm terrified. You know, you look up and you're surrounded by these big, what my wife calls, what do you call them, delivery trucks. You know, the SUVs. She says, why do they want to drive these pickup trucks? All right, something to consider. I got to get some calls real quick. We've just got about 5 minutes left. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Let's see. Here is Kate in Southgate. Kate, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I was responding to a comment you made about the computer economy, MasterCard, Visa.
Sure.
I was a bank teller at Wells Fargo in San Francisco in the mid-70s, and that's when Visa and MasterCard were first coming out.
Right.
And they were selling it to us as, well, this is so convenient for people, and you won't have to worry about money, and the country won't have to worry about producing this money and the dirty money, and, wow, you just have to present this card. And I'm watching this evolve over the years, and people are going for this convenience. And about a year ago, I read in Newsweek magazine where they were testing a new type of economy where your credit card was matched up with a thumbprint.
Oh, God.
Wow, how convenient that is. You don't have to worry if you left your credit card at home. You just present your thumbprint. You have it with you everywhere, of course.
Mm.
And how people, we go for this convenience and don't stop to think what's behind it.
Well, how about this?
Kate? Invading our privacy.
Yeah, how about this? You have your universal cashless producer-consumer card, and you go into the grocery store, and it comes up on the cashier's screen that you owe $1,500 for child support.
You have some type of sort of warrant. It's all tied in.
Yeah, boom, you're gone.
Oh, that's no good.
Thank you, Kate. I got to get
great
some more
point,
calls
Kate.
In about 2 minutes. Thank you for joining us. Here is Valentine in Westland. Go ahead, Valentine. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going today? First time, long time.
Well, great. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, well, I was going to touch on the subject about all the long work hours and things. I'm the first generation born in my family here, and like in Italy, you get a month paid vacation from the government. That's
wow.
From them. And your work day, you can go home and eat lunch. You can take 2 hours off, and they're not going to like take away, you know, your pay for it. And that's the way they've been doing it for a long time. And, like, with their college system is the same way. They're, by the time they're 18, they're already out of college there. My mom was working in Vatican City as a nun. I mean, not a nun, as a nurse.
I was going to say.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she was actually studying. She was actually studying to be a nun, but she didn't get that far. She ended up going as a nurse.
Well, that's good, because otherwise we wouldn't be talking to you.
Exactly. But, yeah, I mean, those kind of things. And I'm wondering why we can't have that in this country. I mean, they don't produce as much money as we do. And they, you know, their population's ready to go work when they're 18, fully educated.
Well, it's how the money is allocated. We're the wealthiest country in the world, even still, even with selling off all our assets to foreign investors and being in hock to foreign banks. But as long as you keep living in a military-industrial complex with spending half a trillion dollars a year, it's all going to winding up the same, and people are going to think they've got good jobs when they get $9 an hour.
That's right.
All right, got to run. Thanks for bringing that up. We got to get one more call in here. It's Kenneth from Detroit. Kenneth, thanks for being our last caller on WRIF.
Oh, I just made it in, huh?
You did. Go ahead.
How you doing, Peter and Jolene?
We are doing
great. Show. Great show. I really appreciate it. Hey, I wanted to talk about how we are with our elections been so bad, and, you know, no one trusts, you know, the outcome for the presidential election. Don't you think it's about time we get a paper trail? You know, it should be very easily with the electronic voting and the computers we're using now. Just have a... You know, after we make our vote, just get a receipt for our vote.
You know, Kenneth, I think they're starting to install that in
a number of voting
systems. Yeah.
I mean, how about this?
How about, remember, I don't know if you go back that far, but they used to have voting booths or voting, what do they call them, houses? They were these green houses that the only thing they served the function for was.
They're like metal, weren't
for
they?
For voters, somehow.
I don't know.
But in any event, you went in there, they gave you a paper ballot, and you gave you a pen, and you put a check or you filled in a little box, and then people counted them. And then you know what? You couldn't have the results at 8:30 p.m. It actually took, you know, maybe you wouldn't even find out till 24 hours later.
I'm all for it. How about you, Peter?
Oh, yeah.
That sounds good. All
yeah.
right. Got to go. Thank you, Kenneth. Thanks for being our last caller. Jolene Jordan, thank you so much. You look like you're ready to roll.
I'm just cold. That's
yeah.
all.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, Al. Thank you to the listeners. Thank you to Steve, too.
I think Steve is in there. Did he go home?
I don't know, but we'll thank Steve anyway.
Yes. And
being a great guy.
Great interviews coming up right after these. We'll talk next week.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. A pleasure to bring back an old friend, someone we've interviewed any number of times on the Peter Werby Show. He's a Detroiter. And we would never call him an ex-Detroiter, Jeff Cohn. Hey. Jeff Cohn is the author of Cable News Confidential, where he worked for quite a number of years as a producer, including as a producer of The Donahue Show. And Jeff, along with Scott Ritter, who we've interviewed as well, the former U.N. arms inspector in Iraq, is going to be in our town Saturday, January 26th, 2 to 4 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church of Ferndale on Woodward. We'll give you more information as soon as I bring in Jeff. Jeff, welcome home.
Hey, you can take the kid out of Detroit, but not the Detroit out of the kid. Is that how it's
something like that. Now, here for this event that's sponsored by Peace Action of Michigan and the Huntington Woods Peace Group, they say Iran threat or another lie. But you and Scott Ritter, you said before the before our broadcast here that it was much broader than that.
Well, it's broader because we discuss Iraq, the current situation, the new threats to Iran, and the news media. And both Scott Ritter and I are absolutely obsessed with Iraq. He's not a young man. I'm certainly not a young man. But the run-up to the invasion of Iraq has shaped a lot of our views and really was a turning point for both of us. I witnessed the run-up to Iraq from inside the corporate TV news. I was at Fox News and then at MSNBC during that period. Scott Ritter was a guy who was trying to go tell the American public what he knew based on being a UN weapons inspector. And as we got closer to the war, I got taken off the air. The show I was working on, Phil Donahue, got canceled. Scott Ritter was virtually blacklisted. Everything that Scott Ritter and Phil Donahue and I said on the air about what would happen if the United States troops invaded Iraq, all of that stuff has happened. So when we see the new threats at Iran with the same flimsy evidence, the same concocted evidence, the same people making the same claims, the same reporters using the same unnamed intelligence sources, then it's deja vu all over again. So our talks have been really about Iraq and Iran, and crucially, how you can't trust the corporate media on any of those kinds of subjects.
And you and Scott Ritter, Jeff Cohn, have been touring the United States. In fact, there's a website, ustouroftheduty.org, and you can find the entire schedule if you're listening other than on the station, like if you're listening to the stream and hearing it somewhere else other than the Detroit area. Now, that's interesting because people almost get the idea that George Bush calls MSNBC or Cheney or somebody like that and says, get rid of Cohn and Donahue and don't let Ritter on again. What's the process by where the voice that turned out to be absolutely accurate, people I depended on, I mean, I quoted you, I quoted Scott Ritter back in late 2002, early 2003, and that's how I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. What's the process by which you got canned?
I wish it were as simple as you laid out, where there's a few, you know, people making calls and a few people taking the calls, because if it was just this little conspiracy of a few evil people, the situation wouldn't be so bad. The situation is worse because it's a corporate structure in the news media where the people who rise to the top are, I saw this over and over. You know, you always hear conservatives say they're for a meritocracy where your advancement is based on achievement or individual ability. What we have in the corporate media is the exact opposite of it. There's a word for it in the dictionary. Literally, it means rule by the worst, cacistocracy.
Where, you know, I love it.
So these principled people rise to the top, and we saw it over and over. So, you know, before I got there, to MSNBC, as soon as I took stock of the place, I realized, gee, at the lower levels here at MSNBC, run by the top news division, NBC News, there's some good people here, some good journalists, there's some good people on the Donahue staff, there were some good people, and they're usually the lower level, mid-level journalists who are the least powerful, especially in a time of war. And then you looked at the people at the top, they weren't journalists. These people at the top who run these TV networks, they're politicians, they're diplomats, they're corporate insiders. And they get freaked out when there's a voice going, cutting against the grain, as Phil Donahue's show was doing, as I was doing when I was on the air. I lost my interview, my debate slot on MSNBC months before they canceled the Phil Donahue show. They canceled Phil 3 weeks before the invasion of Iraq.
What'd they tell you? Why were they canceling your show?
Clearly, it was what they told us the whole way is we've got to muzzle ourselves. It's too liberal. It's too angry. We're getting complaints. You're anti-American. You're un-American. We heard it every single day. We were given orders in the last months of Donahue that when we booked one guest who was anti-war, we had two that were pro-war.
If two?
We had two guests on the left, we had to book three on the right. If we at one meeting, and this is famous, again, I've got a whole book about this, Cable News Confidential. No one has ever challenged a single fact in the book. At one meeting where there are about 15 producers, one producer says she's thinking of booking Michael Moore on the Donahue show, and she's told that she'd have to have, for political balance, three right-wingers. So, you know, I mean, we knew what was going on. As the war neared, our top management was getting more petrified. They didn't want to be a maverick. They didn't want to have a show that was raising questions. I'm sure there was some problems with General Electric, which owns MSNBC. We know that General Electric lobbyists at that very time were trying to get the rules changed at the FCC to allow the, you know, few media titans to become even more titanic. So it's a complex situation that where journalism is muzzled on the shop floor because of the corporate managers that are either conservative or timid, but the one thing they don't want to do is polarize with the Bush administration when their lobbyists need the Bush administration to give them even more power and control over the broadcast airwaves. That was the complex series of events happening at that time.
Well, Jeff Cohen, this, of course, wasn't a shock to you. You founded Fairness and Accuracy in reporting, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting with fair.org. So, I just said, you weren't shocked. You were probably angered and what have you. But
You know what, Peter? People always say, how come I'm in a constant state of shock?
I'm shocked you're shocked.
Yeah, well, the reality is I always think it's going to get better. And it always gets worse. You know, I thought when I got in at MSNBC, and I didn't go over there until I got certain conditions. You know, they said that Phil would be allowed to be Phil, that I would be on a show with a left-right debate, and I could say whatever I wanted. And, you know, I was given all of these promises, and I thought, well, okay, maybe I've happened to fall into the right corporate media outlet at the right time, and I'm going to have a little more freedom than normal. And it turned out that MSNBC treated me worse than I was treated at Fox News in the previous 5 years.
Right.
So, yeah, I was shocked. I was stunned to see that journalism was not allowed to be practiced in any way. You know, the rest of the shows on MSNBC, you know, they were like basically pushing for war, so many of the shows, not all of them. And our show, I kept saying, look, we're competing with Bill O'Reilly. He's an open partisan. No one at Fox News says, Bill, you have to be more balanced. You have to muzzle yourself. You have to tone it down. And he's the biggest guy in talk television, in cable news. Do you want us to get ratings or not? And, you know, I was in conversation at that time with the top people at this TV channel, MSNBC, and I realized that journalism was not at all in their interest, and believe it or not, ratings was not even what concerned them at the time. What concerned them at the time, I'm talking about the months before the invasion of Iraq, what concerned them at the time was not rocking any boats whatsoever. That was far more important even than ratings, and they wouldn't let us get the ratings. You know, Amy Goodman, all sorts of blogs and independent websites, they were booming during those months.
Sure.
If Phil Donahue had been the one place that had dissenting voices like Scott Ritter, and Scott could come on and not be outshouted by three hawks, we would have had ratings going through the roof, but they were less interested in ratings than tamping down the controversy.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Cohn is my guest, author of Cable News Confidential. He'll be in our town on Saturday, January 26th, along with Scott Ritter, the former U.N. arms inspector in Iraq. And I'll give you all the information. If you're, you know, if you're just catching a part of this, you can always go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and go to my calendar, and this will have all the details on it. Now, Jeff, you said that there was such a similarity between the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and what's happening now in Iran. But, I mean, haven't we learned our lesson a little? It seems like there's so much critical response to the saber-rattling over there, and we have Keith Olbermann on MSNBC. That's their most popular host, and I don't see any... boy, he sure isn't muzzled. He says things that I lost station after station
right.
for 5-6 years ago and, you know, when I worked for the old IE America radio network. So it seems like, haven't we made a little bit of advance?
Well, I think that... As you say, Olbermann is saying on air far more than, say, the Phil Donahue show got fired in 2003. There's no doubt that the political ambiance in the general culture and the American public in general has changed for the better. But in terms of who runs the media and who runs the most influential outlets, whether it's the New York Times, Washington Post, which were very hawkish, the Washington Post hawkish editorial page with regard to Iraq, New York Times front page was instrumental in the invasion of Iraq. Have we learned a little bit? I don't think so. I really think it's even more dangerous. We've just had the introduction of this videotape from the Navy
right.
that purported to show five Iranian speedboats threatening, you know, the three U.S. warships that are in the Strait of Hormuz just a few miles off the coast of Iran. And, of course, the Strait of Hormuz is from where a U.S. guided missile brought down a civilian airliner 20 years ago near the end of the Iran-Iraq war and killed nearly 300 people and 66 children. These Iranian speedboats, according to a tape provided by the Pentagon, that aired on every single national TV and radio network, including PBS and NPR, there's a voice on there that says, I am coming to you. You will explode after a few minutes. And that was added onto a videotape. It was an audio radio transmission that was added to this videotape, and it aired everywhere. And then within a matter of days, the Navy had to admit that they had no clue where that threatening voice, threatening U.S. warships, where it came from. They said they can't tell at all whether it came from the Iranian speedboats. They can't tell at all whether it came from an Iranian. In fact, there's evidence it came from somewhere else. It sounded to me like the voice of Borat. But the reality is that, you know, FAIR has, the Media Watch group FAIR has been doing this research on this video incident. When there, all these doubts are raised, they got nothing close to the prominence of the original scare. So all you have all the TV and radio networks, as you say, you know, shouldn't they be wiser years after they got taken in the invasion of Iraq? And here comes a videotape. Did they ask to authenticate it? Did they ask how come this audio threat has no background noise on it? I mean, it took days for there to be doubts, and those doubts were aired on back pages.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you and Scott Ritter appear in Detroit, as I said, the title of your talk is more limited than what you're going to discuss, but it's Iran threat or another lie. On the face of it, and George Bush was just in the Middle East and described Iran as this immense threat to the United States' interests and to the people of the region and the nations of the region. And, you know, we have this projected as this bellicose president, Ahmadinejad. Have we ever heard Bush pronounce his name?
I certainly have.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. He said today that that he's sure that they're building a nuclear. They seek a nuclear weapon, that they would like one. So, and you know, the far right wing says this is Germany and Hitler in 1939. Right. It certainly looks, the portrayal is, this is a pretty dangerous bunch.
Well, it's the same thing we heard around Iraq. We heard Saddam compared to Hitler, now Ahmadinejad is Hitler. We heard Iraq was a weapons of mass destruction menace, and now Iran is. Even though the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, headed by Mohammed El-Baradei, has said year after year after year, and now they have the most extensive nuclear weapons inspections in the history of the world going on in Iran. And El-Baradei keeps saying with confidence, we have seen not one iota of evidence that there's a nuclear weapons threat. And George Bush's scare claims are treated with huge prominence, very little skepticism in mainstream media. And El-Baradei, who, by the way, in the last few days has just met with the supreme leader of Iran, his meeting with the supreme leader of Iran, in which the supreme leader says that it's against Islam to have a nuclear weapon. It's a, you know, and that should say, should at least get into the news media for what it's worth. It doesn't get that kind of play. There are facts. There are experts. Those are the ones that don't appear in the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead we have Bush and the bluster from all the right wingers, the op-ed pages, the hawkish think tanks. You have a guy like Glenn Beck, who's now got a primetime show on CNN every night, headline news. Here's a guy who was completely wrong about Iraq, who cheered us into the invasion of Iraq, who wished on the air on all his Clear Channel stations for the death of Congressman Kucinich. On the air, he wished for the death of Michael Moore.
Wait, I missed all this. Flesh that one out a little.
When Glenn Beck was a huge voice pushing for the war in Iraq on his radio stations, and by the way, he was involved in these so-called pro-troop rallies,
right,
which were really pro-war rallies organized through some of these Clear Channel stations. He was on the air where he would describe the pleasure he would get to be able to witness the violent death of Dennis Kucinich, the anti-war congressman. He had a similar rap about Michael Moore, how he fantasized about strangling him to death.
Well, you know, if I said that on any of my radio broadcasts, you know how fast I'd be out of a job?
Well, especially imagine if you had different enemies.
Yeah.
The key thing is who your enemies are.
Exactly.
I've known you for decades. I know you talk about corporate abuse and government abuse and liars. You know, you've got the wrong enemies. If you were barking at progressive activists, Glenn Beck is the guy who called Cindy Sheehan, who lost her son in Iraq, a prostitute. And after that track record, what does CNN do? They give him a primetime show every night on headline news where he can spend the last year pushing for a military confrontation in Iran. Glenn Beck knows no more about Iran than he knew about Iraq.
But Iran is also accused of meddling in Iraq.
Right. That's so.
What are they doing, meddling in Iraq?
Well, look, remember Michael Gordon with Judith Miller at the New York Times front page? They wrote story after story about the Iraqi nuclear weapons threat. It was completely wrong, completely sourced to unnamed intelligence sources. It was Michael Gordon in February of last year who wrote the crucial front page story for the New York Times, where he's saying that the supreme leader of Iran had approved sending lethal explosives into Iraq to attack U.S. soldiers. It was that front page article completely based on unnamed intelligence sources, unnamed White House sources. And then within a matter of a few days, President Bush has to step back from this claim that they have evidence somehow that Iran's supreme leader is sending in explosives to be used against our soldiers in Iraq. The idea that Iran has this huge border with Iraq is somehow the main cause of the bogged down occupation and the destruction of that country of Iraq is insane. Again, it would be laughed at and is laughed at in mainstream media around the world. But what Bush says even today about Iran, even after lying so badly, he and Cheney, 4 years ago about Iraq, it gets taken with credibility. You have people like Michael Gordon in the New York Times have even more power now than when they got it all wrong in the run-up to Iraq invasion. These guys are just, you know, they're playing the same old tune, and it's very, very scary. The good news is, Peter, that independent media are booming,
mm-hmm.
independent websites and blogs. you know, programs like yours, Democracy Now!, there's independent voices now, especially on the Internet and some off the Internet, that are getting a different view forward. That's the exciting thing. That's been going on now, you know, in the last few years, a big boom in the independent media. And I would say that a large part of the big boom in the independent media is there's so many exiles, internal exiles from corporate mainstream media. They no longer trust corporate U.S. mainstream media. That's a great thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff Cohn, you and Scott Ritter are going to be in the Detroit area on in Ferndale at the First United Methodist Church, and that information will be both at hwpeace.org, also on my website, peterwerby.com, and it'll be this Saturday, January 26th. You know, with all of the lies that are being told and the similarities between the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and you know, what's happening now with Iran, I still have a bet that there is not going to be an attack on Iran by the United States.
I would be more likely to side with you today than I would have a few months ago. But we should perhaps have this conversation again, because Scott Ritter, who knows this stuff better than I, Scott Ritter says if there's going to be an attack on Iraq, it would be a military, you know, armed bombardment.
Yeah, sure.
And it would happen between, he believes, March and June of next year.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could spend, in fact, we just have a couple minutes left. And by the way, people, if you're saying, well, I heard Jeff Cohn, I don't have to come to the rally, the meeting on January 26th, let me tell you two things. First, that Jeff Cohn is a mutual admiration society, has so much knowledge, so much direct experience in media, politics, and you've traveled to Iraq and Iran, haven't you?
No, we were on our way to Iran. Scott Ritter was just there a year ago, and he's on his way back immediately.
Okay, and so there is a lot more. Scott Ritter, who we identified as a former U.N. arms inspector in Iraq, also a Marine, who I believe, in talking to him, voted for George Bush in 2000. Yeah. Tell us his importance and his centrality to all this.
As Seymour Hersh says about Scott Ritter, the most important thing to know about Scott Ritter is that he was right. Scott Ritter is truly an amazing figure, an American military intelligence officer. When you listen to him, you hear a military intelligence officer. He knows of what he speaks. He's the kind of person who won't let his intelligence be misused by the people up the chain. It's truly amazing to hear a guy. He's been to Iraq repeatedly and Iran. He was there. He really knows the region, and when you hear him talk, you're thinking to yourself, with all these clowns from like Heritage Foundation and Brookings who've been so wrong for so many years dominating the airwaves, how come Scott Ritter can't be on any of these TV news shows? And the irony is, he can't be on the shows because he was right.
Yeah.
And that makes him somehow dangerous and somehow like, there must be something wrong with this guy because he got it right. And, you know, the more off you are factually, the more on you are on the air.
Yeah.
And so it's, I mean, Scott Ritter, every day I speak alongside him on these tours, we're now out in the West Coast, I learn something new every single night.
Yeah, he is incredible. And as I said, he's been a guest on this show before. You know, I said there was two reasons, and I just said that the two of you had so much to say. But the other thing is, I mean, you could go to jeffcohen.org, C-O-H-E-N, jeffcohen.org, and find parts of this information. I would suggest reading Cable News Confidential that Jeff wrote, but there is something about being out at a public meeting,
right,
and getting off the Internet, leaving your house, yes, getting together with dozens or hopefully hundreds of people that will that gives you a palpable sense that there is something in that old slogan, power to the people.
And Peter, I talk for 22 minutes. Scott will talk for 25 minutes. And then most of the time is question and answer and dialogue and comment. It's truly, we're doing these as like town meetings. People get to speak and be heard and have their questions addressed. That's the key to these kinds of meetings.
Yeah, I think so. And you've been getting good crowds in your travels?
Huge. Last night we're in Walnut Creek, California, the Unitarian Church, and it was standing room only. It was because it was truly incredible.
Well, one never can tell what constitutes history. I mean, people that were involved in stuff in the 30s or the 60s or something like that probably didn't know that people were going to be studying what they were, what they had taken part in. Who knows? This could be a meeting that will go down in history. Be part of it, even if it's not. It has the capacity to unite you with people that think similarly or on the other hand, challenge your beliefs directly and in person. So the meeting is titled Iran, Threat or Another Lie, but it's going to take on all of U.S. foreign policy. It's sponsored by Peace Action of Michigan and the Huntington Woods Peace Group. You can go to a number of websites, ustourofduty.org, hwpeace.org. The meeting is going to be Saturday, January 26, 2 to 4 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church of Ferndale. It's at 9.5 Mile Road and on the west side of the street. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and that'll give you all the details as well. Jeff Cohn, as usual, thanks for joining me on the broadcast.
Thanks. Can't wait to see people in Detroit.
This is WRIM.com.
On 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. As usual, a pleasure to be with you. I was thinking the other day about how many of you listeners are really familiar in a large way with J. Edgar Hoover, the G-man, one of the most powerful men in American history. Certainly, it all raises our memories or the histories we've read, if you're younger, of the FBI and crime fighting and commie busting and all that. Yep. But it's sort of beginning to fade. Well, here's a way to bring it right back to your memory. A wonderful book, it's called J. Edgar Hoover, a graphic biography by Rick Geary. And Rick Geary, you may know him. He's the winner of an Inkpot Award, and he's worked for Marvel Entertainment Group, DC Comics, Dark Horse Comics, and Heavy Metal, and he's contributed to National Lampoon and the New York Times Book Review. It's a pleasure to welcome Rick Geary. Thanks for joining us on the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Good to be here.
And so a graphic novel or graphic biography, these are drawings in what, like we used to call, cartoons. Is it offensive at all to say this is a cartoon book, or is it important to say that it's a graphic biography?
Well, cartoon may be a little misleading because it's not a humorous book, although my graphic style, my pen and ink style is slightly skewed, slightly exaggerated. It's not strictly realistic. So I don't know what kind of category this would fall into, because this whole field is just kind of getting into, getting going now, and there aren't really any precise terms to talk about it yet, I don't think. There's the term graphic novel, which has been used a lot, but that's kind of misleading in this case, since it's not a novel. It's certainly nonfiction and historical, and I try to be incredibly clear and accurate all the way through. So people can just call it whatever they please, I guess.
Now, is this your first book of this nature?
Well, no, actually, for the past 10 years, I've been producing a series of books under the general title A Treasury of Victorian Murder, and I have 9 volumes in that series now, and each book tells about a particular 19th century murder case, starting with Jack the Ripper and then the Lizzie Borden case, and I deal with the Lincoln assassination, and the most recent one I did was called The Bloody Benders, which is about a homicidal family in rural Kansas in the 1870s. So this is the field I've been working in for the majority of my time over the past 10 years. So this Hoover book was kind of a logical progression, I think.
I was going to say, Rick Geary, I think there's a pattern developing here. What's the interest? What's the fascination? I mean, there's a lot of blood and guts and murder and crime. And
well, I don't know. I've always had this fascination for the Victorian era and the manners and morals, and as well as the physical trappings, costumes and interiors, especially the murder cases. And since they occurred so long ago, you can get a little bit of an ironic distance on them and treat them in a I won't call it a cartoonish style, but there's a little bit of humor involved. So this has always been a fascination of mine, especially the unsolved cases, and I try to really lay out all the facts as clearly as I possibly can, and let the reader take it from there. I usually don't have any theories of my own to promote.
In your J. Edgar Hoover graphic biography, certainly Hoover was born just after or just about the time the Victorian age ended at the end of the 19th century.
Right.
Hoover was born in 1895, but in many ways, even though he lived into the early 1970s, he was a sort of a Victorian in many, many ways.
Well, yes, he was. He kind of had that sort of mindset, and also the fact that he grew up in Washington, D.C., which was in effect a southern town. He carried a lot of those prejudices with him far into the 20th century, and he certainly spent most of his time accumulating power around himself and becoming the notorious character we know today.
Mm-hmm. certainly during from the 30s through the 60s, maybe even the early 60s, J. Edgar Hoover was a man of great public admiration. He, of course, fought to all these dangerous gangsters like John Dellinger and Pretty Boy Floyd and those folks, and then his work against the communist menace. But what began to deteriorate with the rise of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement of the New Left in the 1960s, it all went away. But tell us about this golden age of J. Edgar Hoover, between the 30s and 1960.
A lot of people have forgotten, in the early years of his career, he was a heroic figure. Yes, I think the Bureau and Hoover in particular gained their reputation in the early 1930s. It was the people like John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Machine Gun Kelly was the gangster whom, upon his capture, supposedly, this is according to legend, first used the term G-men in telling the agents, don't shoot G-men.
Huh.
And that name kind of stuck in the popular imagination.
Well, that's better than don't tase me, bro, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, G-Man, that's interesting that it came from the mouths of an FBI target.
Yeah.
Because there were even movies called G-Man, and that was a very, very constant phrase. Well, maybe take us back and tell us a little about J. Edgar Hoover, not so much his childhood or anything, but say beginning with 1917, which, we talk now about George Bush's attacks on the civil liberties of American dissenters, but it was pretty ferocious during that period under Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat.
Under the Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer, who, the kind of stuff he got away with just wouldn't be stood for today at all. And, 1917 was the year that Hoover first entered the government service. And in 1919 was when he became the underling to A. Mitchell Palmer, and they initiated their mass arrests of radicals and immigrants throughout the country. They deported about 200 communists in what they thought would be the first of many such deportations, but there was only one before the public and the Congress kind of caught on to what was going on and reined them in. They were instrumental in initiating these mass arrests and holding people in detention camps and without access to attorneys or anything like that. It kind of makes you think of Guantanamo today.
Well, also, as I was telling you before the broadcast, it's just come out of a newly declassified document that Hoover, in 1950, wanted to suspend the rules against illegal detention and arrest up to 12,000 Americans that he, J. Edgar Hoover, suspected of being disloyal. Fortunately, President Truman paid no attention to it. But he had gotten his early work in on proposals like that during and just after World War One.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and he just wanted to carry it on through. Luckily, people like Truman had, were on to what he was up to, and certainly put the brakes on him. But when Eisenhower came in, he found kind of a friendly power in the White House who's supported a lot of what he did.
He said in fact, you relate this in your graphic biography, J. Edgar Hoover, that Hoover himself said that the Eisenhower years were the happiest of his life.
Yeah, they were kind of the peak of his power in many ways. Hoover's support of Joseph McCarthy kind of crumbled there in the early years of the Eisenhower administration. But during those years, Hoover just amassed great power for himself and the FBI. They could do just about anything to insinuate themselves into people's private lives. And Hoover also made himself a very wealthy man at that time through his friendships with different financial figures.
And this is incredible. I mean, there's so much there. I mean, even in the sentences that you just related. But he was a government bureaucrat on a bureaucratic salary. Yet, as you say, he had rich and powerful right-wing anti-communist friends.
Oh, absolutely.
Who gifted him with? I mean, gifted him to the point that he became a wealthy man.
Well, yes, giving him, insider information, the kind of stuff that, would be thought of as illegal.
I mean, he was actually given the cash, wealth.
That too, and he was treated to vacation trips and supposedly even had friendships with different organized crime figures, which is a totally different realm.
Now, let's go back to the 30s. J. Edgar Hoover, of course, was renowned for fighting the kind of gangsters that mostly came out of the working class, rural America, poverty areas. Yeah, it was said that at that same time the mafia was growing in great power and that he never really was very successful against them at all.
I know it was toward the late 50s it was finally remarked upon that the FBI really hadn't been doing anything at all against organized crime. And the FBI made excuses for this in a lot of different ways, but some people have suggested that Hoover did form friendships with a lot of these crime figures, and they might have had something on him, but that's just rumor so far.
Mm-hmm.
But the FBI usually excused themselves by saying that he didn't want his agents to be put in the position of being blackmailed, and he didn't feel that the FBI had the jurisdiction. This is one of the regular excuses they used for not doing something, although, because he felt that crime was a local problem in a lot of ways, organized criminals didn't fall under his jurisdiction.
Hmm. J. Edgar Hoover is the book. It's a graphic biography by Rick Geary, and you're listening to The Peter Werby Show. It's published by Hill & Wang, and, Rick, I just looked on the spine, and it says, Hill & Wang, Serious Comics.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, Serious Comics is the company that's actually assembled the project.
Oh, okay. So it's not a description. It's actually the name of the company.
Yes.
That's great. That's great. Well, tell us, one of the things that has only come about recently, and we see this in the election campaigns of this year, is this intense scrutiny of the private lives and the private utterances and even a laugh or a tear of a candidate. Yet most public figures, from Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Jack Kennedy and Hoover himself, they were obscured from public view. We only got their sort of idealized, spectacularized presentation, and no one would have dared to talk about the private life of J. Edgar Hoover, which was pretty weird, wasn't it?
It was very weird, yes. It was probably not as weird as a lot of people think, because he was an incredibly secretive person, but it's the kind of thing that the press would leap upon today. Back in those days, it was kind of a gentleman's agreement, I guess, that you just didn't delve into government officials' private lives, but all that's out the window now.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are aware that Hoover had a long-term relationship with his second-in-command at the Bureau, Clyde Tolson. Whether they were actual lovers or whether Hoover was an active and practicing homosexual is still not positively confirmed, although, there are a lot of clues that point in that direction, but there are a lot of clues that point to his being a more or less asexual character.
Well, let me just interrupt you there. I mean, on the other hand, he was extraordinarily hostile towards gays, but which doesn't contradict whatsoever, as we know from recent exposure.
No, not at all.
But one of the things, you kind of deflated one of my balloons. I always said that the J. Edgar Hoover FBI building in Washington is the only public building named after a cross-dresser. But you're not real solid on that being confirmed.
Well, no, I wanted to be... pretty even-handed in my treatment here. So I did bring up a lot of the accusations and rumors, but I also put in a lot of cautionary information as well. Like, a lot of these stories just don't have a lot of, reliability behind them. A lot of them have been told by unreliable people who had an axe to grind against Hoover.
Sounds like me.
Yeah,
could. Well, I don't want to repeat stories that aren't true, but I don't know. That one's funny enough, maybe.
It is a good
one. You know what? Whenever I tell it, I will make reference to Rick Geary's J. Edgar Hoover, a graphic biography, and say that that it was from unreliable sources and not confirmed.
Yeah. Unreliable sources say.
How did J. Edgar Hoover do during World War II against Nazi and Japanese espionage?
Well, he was he wanted the FBI to be the major entity to handle domestic espionage, and but he was disappointed when the OSS was formed, which later became the CIA, and that kind of took over a lot of the a lot of the tasks that Hoover thought the FBI should handle, and but the bureau was still active in rooting out un-American activity and in promoting home front security, things like that. And there was this major case in which they captured some Nazi spies who had come ashore in New York and in Florida, and that was one of the major headlines of the time. But Hoover during World War II kept his prejudices under wraps in order to become part of the national effort against the Germans and Japanese.
Mm-hmm. He was, as your book relates, quite a racist. Maybe, in fact, you have a quote. I should have marked it. I don't know where that he says that colored people, even if given the chance of education, wouldn't take it and all that. Is that a quote from him?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And, yeah, he was. He retained this racism up, clear up into the civil rights movement, and he kind of had to be dragged kicking and screaming by LBJ to get the Bureau to investigate civil rights cases like the three men who were murdered in Mississippi and Martin Luther King. Hoover hated King and, did everything he could to kind of expose him as an un-American character.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've heard, and you relate, again, some of it about the kind of files and tapes he had on people. And did he actually have real blackmailable power over people in government? It's been heard that he's just had something on everybody.
Well, supposedly, yes. All those files were destroyed upon his death, but that's certainly the info that's come down to us, that he had juicy things on just about everyone, who were foolish enough to engage in suspicious behavior.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have any scruples about that at all.
Now, how are they destroyed? You would think that's part of the, a national archive.
Well, no. When Hoover died in 72, his associate Tolson, as well as some other people in the office, immediately, I guess this must have been according to Hoover's wishes. They just burned a lot of the files. Just destroyed them totally.
He didn't have any real sense that there were checks and balances on him at all, did he?
No, not at all. Not at all. he was a power unto himself. And this is why when Nixon came to office,
even though Hoover and Nixon had been friends and associates for a long time, the Nixon people kind of viewed Hoover with suspicion and thought he was a dinosaur, and they were eager to get him out of there.
Yeah, well, even though I mean, we were talking about maybe the golden age of Hoover from the 30s through 1960, the 1960 presaged a new era that John Kennedy is elected.
Uh-huh.
The civil rights movement has taken on a greater and greater breadth. There's an anti-war movement, a hippie movement, a counterculture, all of that. And you would have thought that would have been grist for Hoover's mill, but with the Kennedys in, he didn't fare well, did he?
No, not at all. Not at all. He, in fact, some sources I read said that he wanted to kind of back away from using the Bureau's power to expose to undermine the anti-war movement and a lot of the civil rights activity toward the end of the 60s. He became very wary of using too much of the FBI's power. He thought that it would either be illegal or it would be unpopular.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't like the Kennedys.
Yeah. They were barely speaking by the time JFK was shot. They kind of retained cordial public relations, but in private they were really ignoring each other pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real tense situation, especially Bobby Kennedy, who this young guy who became Hoover's boss in effect at the Justice Department, and you know, Hoover was in no mood to accept any kind of domination.
Well, he must have had lots on Jack and Bobby, though.
Well, yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It was. Yeah, it was definitely part of the files that got destroyed later on.
Well, did that forestall the hand of the Kennedys trying to control him at all, do you think?
Well, they were definitely in favor of, ousting Hoover, and they were looking forward to his mandatory retirement in 1965 because there's really no way they could get him out of there and before then. But then, of course, after LBJ came in, he waived the mandatory retirement, so Hoover became director for life, in effect.
Yeah, and I guess he probably had a few things on old LBJ as well.
Oh, probably.
Yeah, well, Gary, we're getting towards the end of our interview, and one of the things I didn't ask you was another technical aspect of your graphic biography of J. Edgar Hoover, and that is when you read at least six biographies of Hoover, then you had to kind of select what are you going to draw? How did, with all the information and all the books, how do you assemble the imagery that's best going to summarize Hoover's life?
Well, that's it gets a little difficult in some places. In most of the time, though, the imagery is dictated by the story itself. After I write a script in which I take all these little pieces of information and divide them up into panels, so many panels per page, and then is when I'm actually sitting down to actually draw is when I decide on what imagery to use. And a lot of it is dictated by the narrative at that point, either portraits of people or pictures of objects or buildings. And I try not to get too repetitive because the imagery can get repetitive. So I have to use my imagination sometimes. And I go online or go to books and use a lot of reference photos from the period.
Uh-huh.
It all depends upon the imagery on the page about how the panels flow into each other. It a lot depends on intuition, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Now, the voice balloons and the narrative blocks, those aren't hand-lettered, are they?
No. Actually, for a lot of my projects, I do hand-lettering, but in this, I deferred to the people who are putting the book together, and they use a computer font that
still looks
hand-lettered.
It does. I was almost hesitant about asking. One time I was talking to a graphic artist, and he was more, I don't know if the word, it was a question of whether to use something. He was more defensive of the lettering than he was of his larger image. I guess because this would take an enormously long time. Well, it's a terrific book. It's a great way to look at the life of probably one of the most powerful men in American history, J. Edgar Hoover. It's a graphic biography by Rick Geary. It's published by Hill & Wang. Should be available everywhere. I'll have a link to it on my site, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Rick Geary, thanks for joining me on the broadcast.
Thank you very much, Peter.
This is WRIM.com.
Great call, San Francisco. Thank you.
To Maui.
Well, all I can say to you is aloha!
Oh, Scott, Eric, this is great.
Absolutely, man. Who is this?
This is Dave Purcell.
Well, Dave, you're going to Maui. Who's rocking your world today, my friend?
WRAF.
Baby.
Keep listening. Your next chance to win could come at any time. The Riff, Maui Time 2008, exclusively from Budweiser. And your official Maui Time station, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Baby.
connected through another other episode. Lashing out, one of the better moves you bubble for your listen show. You and me.